Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Yeah, I've got to wonder how much of that's going to come up tomorrow in the State of the Union address. Now, I mean, the president's supposed to be talking about income inequality, some other things. What exactly is that going to look like when you're pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, which, as we've learned, these free trade agreements, in my view, and I think in many's view, makes inequality worse. Not just here in the U.S., but across the globe. I think it's pretty clear. Yeah, here we are, another one. Also, we're going to talk about tomorrow's big press conference at the Capitol, 10 a.m., the Capitol Rotunda in Harrisburg. A number of groups are going to come across the state together to highlight the Koch brothers' arm of the GOP here, pushing this poison that they're calling paycheck protection, which there's no protection. Understand this. This is pure and simple an attack on workers who right now still have a voice. It's about taking a voice from those who have it to make them voiceless like the rest of us. That's all it's about. It's about the big moneyed interest saying we want our way. And one way or another, we're going to take our way. So 10 a.m. tomorrow, I hope a lot of people come out for it. It's going to be informative, but more importantly, a chance to go knock on some doors. I'm going to go see my representative, Stephen Bloom, who bailed on me. Had a little snowstorm one day, a little bit of snow, just a little, actually. Bails on the meeting that we had scheduled. But it wasn't bad enough out for him to cancel his, hey, I'm running again, event. So I guess we know who's more important. Also going to talk about the Supreme Court. Remember last week we talked a little bit about this case that could destroy the rights of tens of thousands of home health care workers across the country. This poison, again, being heavily funded and pushed by these same nefarious, big-moneyed special interests who have been working to destroy workers' rights and consolidate their power into the hands of the very few. You know, the Koch brothers, the Wall Street crowd, the Alex, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Also going to talk about income inequality with the good folks from the Center for Media and Democracy. And in the third hour, we're going to go back and we're going to wrap up our discussion from last week at the Families USA Health Action Conference there in Washington, D.C. Lots of positive feedback from the conversations there. So thanks for getting to me on that. I appreciate it. Good feedback, always nice to hear. And, you know, some of the not-so-good stuff, because it helps us get a little bit better. So I appreciate that. Also tonight, your thoughts, your questions, your comments, whatever's on your mind. What do you think the president's going to talk about tomorrow? What's going to be the key focal issue? What's it going to be? Going to be minimum wage? Is it going to be trade? What's it going to be? Is it going to be infrastructure? We want our bank. What do you see as the topic in tomorrow's State of the Union address? Now, it doesn't really matter because the right's going to say no. He could come out and say, well, we need to cut taxes down to zero for billionaires and 100% on people making minimum wage. And the right would still say no. It's not low enough for the rich people. We need negative tax rates for them. And we'll get to some of that as well. So big news in Philadelphia today. State representative and his sister were arrested. Jose J.P. Miranda, 34-year-old Democrat, arrested, charged with this ghost worker plot. Evidently, you can't hire a family member to be in chief of staff or in your office. I guess there's some kind of nepotism clause. So they hired, I guess he hired somebody that he would pay and that they would funnel the money to his sister. And he didn't have to actually do anything. And I am so glad that someone got caught. Good, get caught. Now we can move on. Get rid of these bums. I don't care what side of the aisle they're on. And good. Now, I know. There's corruption. Yeah, we found it. Weeding it out. Good thing. So it'll be interesting to hear the stories all about that. Personally, had a very interesting weekend. Very interesting day today. My daughter finally, my 11-year-old, finally, we've been doing basketball all season long. doing the practices every Mondays and Fridays, games on Saturdays, hours and hours we've been spending coaching the team. We're saying, come on, we're going to do well. Finally gets the thought that from the wing, she can take two dribbles to the center of the lane, little 8 to 10 foot jump shot, bang. Finally does it. As I've been saying all season long, got to do this. Finally to the lane, takes the shot, nails it. Comes down on someone's foot, twists her ankle. Done for the season. So yesterday, I'm at the doctor's office. We went to one of those emergency center places, which I thought was fabulous. We were in and out in under an hour. It was fantastic. Things we should be doing more of in the healthcare world. But it was one of those moments where I stopped and I go, you know, I'm fortunate that I'm not one of the 40-some, 47, 48 million people in this country who don't have insurance. Because it wasn't a thought of, well, I can't afford to take her. It was a thought of, it might be broken. We should probably have it looked at. So we were making a medical decision, not a financial decision. And I don't want people to have to make financial decisions. And you hear the right talk about this all the time. Well, you should speed dial. No, we went to the place that was open. Now, he had two choices. You had the emergency room, you had one of these emergency care centers. Probably going to be a little cheaper going to the emergency care center. I think, and I've been saying this for years, we should be redeveloping our entire healthcare system so that when you have something like that, there are places available. And maybe as a matter of public service, of public good, maybe we should fund it. So maybe it's not up to the profiteers to say, you know what, we can gouge you just a little bit less than the emergency room does. And maybe say, you know what, we're going to make sure as a public good everyone has access to it. But it got me really to thinking about, you know, and as I was sitting there, and granted I didn't have long to think about it, but it got me thinking about, you know, what if he didn't have insurance? What if this was a major expense? I mean, a couple $100 for most people, that's a major expense. And now I see schools have dropped insurance plans. So if my daughter wants to play basketball next year, I have to have health insurance for her. Or she can't play. Or you risk, me having to pocket the debt if she falls, breaks an ankle. You know, when I was in school, the school had insurance. So if you didn't have insurance, the school would cover it as a last resort. They don't do that anymore. Why? Budgets are slashed. And you look at all of this extraction from the working class of this country, all of the options going away, all of the cuts seem to be, the 1,000 paper cuts to the bottom of the economic ladder. I mean, all of these, everywhere you look, and you just stop and you look around, just from 10 or 15 years ago, how much things have changed and how the dynamics of this country have shifted to the very few who continue to get so much of what this country has to offer, while everybody else, not so much. And we hear people pointing fingers and, oh, you lazy welfare people, or those lazy unemployed. It's really very bizarre to me. And right now you see all this money, tons of money, hundreds of millions of dollars being spent on nonsensical legislation designed, well, to really just take people's voice away and to impose other people's will. And I look at this Representative Gordon Denlinger. We talked about this last week. His freedom of conscience amendment, which is nothing more than someone like him who is free to not have a conscience. All this is saying, you know what, I can now justify any discriminatory act. I can now justify denying someone anything as long as I have a conscience. I don't want to give them anything. I don't want to sell them anything. I don't want them in a grocery store. I mean, where does this end? We are moving towards a very bizarre society of a handful of people who are making the decisions for everybody else. And it's their morality, it's their values, it's their thoughts, it's their wishes, it's them who dictate to us, outside of our government. And this is what's frustrating me to really no end. Because you see all of this money flowing to these made-up nonsense, euphemistically named groups, pimping these values that I don't know that most Americans have. And look, I'm not trashing anybody's personal values. If you don't want to have an abortion, don't do it. If you don't want to marry someone of the same sex, don't do it. Nobody's forcing you. If you don't want to take contraception, don't do it. Nobody's jamming it down your throat. But this idea that the Koch brothers and the DeVosses and Sheldon Adelsons and all of these extraordinarily wealthy people have this power to say what we can and we cannot do. The Chick-fil-A guy, all of these people saying, well, it's my value, my belief over everybody else's. Seems very, very twisted to me. And instead of talking about true family values, how to encourage people to, for instance, I'll give you a quick little story. A couple of weeks ago, someone came to me and says, your wife stays at home, right? She's a stay-at-home mom. I go, yeah. Well, I've got a friend who's looking for a sitter for an infant. You know, we want to find someone who can, sit with the infant for 8 hours a day while mom goes to work, because she doesn't have a choice. So my wife said, temporarily, while you're looking for someone, we'll keep the baby for you, because it's got to be tough. I can't imagine, and my wife and I have talked about this. I can't imagine the feeling of leaving my child with a complete stranger, and then going off to work. I can't imagine the desperation in that, and the fear and everything that goes into it. If we truly had a series of values that talked about family, wouldn't we be promoting policies to keep someone home so that they could do that, so that one paycheck could support a family? Wouldn't that be sort of kind of a thought? But instead, we push poison like this freedom of conscience amendment. And the paycheck deception stuff, and all of the attacks on you name the thing that built the middle class, and the wealth class wants to destroy it. And that's right where we are. And I understand there's more money, and it's going to be obscene here in Pennsylvania. Get ready for it, because we've been saying for years it's going to get ugly here eventually. It looks like now is about the time. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about tomorrow's press conference to talk about House Bill 1507, Senate Bill 1034. Again, if you can't go tomorrow at 10 a.m., contact your representative to say this is nonsense. It's ridiculous. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about that and also what we can do to stop it. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
A broad coalition, including labor, farm, internet, and environmental groups, are in the midst of a 10 days to stop fast track movement against the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement. Hundreds of organizations are protesting the secret negotiations that will produce the TPP NAFTA style trade agreement. The Obama administration is pursuing fast track authority to try and take the TPP straight from corporate dominated secret creation sessions to a congressional vote. with no chance to debate or amend the deal. Melinda St. Louis with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch says agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership are bad for workers, bad for the environment, and threaten the ability of the U.S. to enforce environmental regulations. And she says 20 years of data on NAFTA has convinced economists across the board that these deals are raw deals for all but the corporate elite.
The reality is that economists across all stripes, even those who have supported these types of trade agreements in the past, all admit this model of trade agreement is a major contributor to income inequality, to the increase in inequality among Americans.
St. Louis says support of the TPP puts Obama at odds with his stated goal of addressing income inequality.
Among the Obama's base, there is massive opposition. In his own party, this is not something that is popular at all, including in the leadership. And so if he does choose to, in the State of the Union address this coming Tuesday, if he chooses to push for fast track, he will be at odds with the vast majority of his party, and unfortunately will be undermining his stated legacy issue of trying to combat income inequality.
Public Citizen is urging people to call Congress opposing fast track authority for the TPP. Efforts to raise the minimum wage are underway in 30 U.S. states, from Alabama and Alaska to Florida, New Hampshire, Idaho, and many states in between. Democrats are pushing these efforts to raise state minimum wages. The highest minimum wage proposal is in Massachusetts, where the measure would raise it to $11 over 3 years. States can raise their minimum wages above the federal level of $7.25 an hour. Democrats support raising the wages. Republicans generally oppose it. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, unions added 162,000 new members in 2013. Private sector union ranks actually grew by 281,000 workers, but losses of 118,000 union workers from the public sector kept the net gain to 162,000. The overall percentage of American workers in unions held steady at 11.3%. The Department of Labor says union workers have higher median wages, $950 a week, compared to $750 for non-union workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your rights. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
So over the weekend, the Koch brothers were in Palm Springs, California, to raise the idea, raise a couple $100 million to fund their new organizations, or you know, the old ones they have. And I love the names, like Freedom Partners and Center for Shared Services and Americans for Prosperity. It's such wonderful names that they come up with. Now, Freedom Partners, they're doing so well that they're going to, and they're in the process of expanding from the 50-person staff that they have now, want to maybe double that so that they can really focus on what's important, like going after people's workers' rights. Now, this other group that they've come up with, this AGUS, they are going to be spending money hand-picking acceptable Republican candidates so that they can put them on the ticket. And eventually, you know, they'll be funding both sides of it down the road, just down the road, so that they have complete and total control. And in fact, Politico pointed out that the Koch brothers' political operation is in the process of forging a more integrated approach to the political involvement there. They're going to centralize complete control. Basically, they're going to take over the Republican Party. Now, you remember 2012, the Koch brothers, their little network, about $400 million they spent. Americans for Prosperity, obviously the most potent of those. And what I found interesting is that they're saying that, you know, as they move forward, more money, more power, more control, and they're here in Pennsylvania, which is why we've asked Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, to come talk to us. Rick, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, it's always a pleasure to be on the show.
So the Koch brothers were in California, all the big money people from across the country throwing into the pot to attack, well, you and people like you.
Yeah, well, they sat in warm weather in Palm Springs. We sat here fighting for workers in freezing cold temperatures. But you know what? the fight for workers will always keep my blood going.
No, I understand. Tomorrow is the big press conference. We've been talking about this for the past week and a half. Tomorrow, 10 a.m., Capitol Rotunda, to push back against this deceptively named paycheck protection. Tell me what this is.
Well, basically, it's an effort to defund the labor movement. What they're saying is that, the government shouldn't deduct dues from people's paychecks. Well, first of all, it's people's paychecks. It's a right that we negotiate. It's not automatic. Union members have to agree that it should be part of the contract. And, of course, the union leaders that negotiate are democratically elected. So we've had a process that everybody's agreed to, including the governor and the last state employee contract, signed off on the contract that included dues deduction and voluntary political deduction. So now you have these out-of-state billionaires with their own agenda who have looked around and said, who is blocking us from totally destroying the American economy and putting all the money into our pockets? Well, when they look around, they see the labor movement. They see the people who fought to make sure that folks have a 40-hour work week, that we don't have child labor laws, all the things that we've done, and they said, we're in their way. So they have to go after us, and they do that. They can't beat us on one way, so they just change the rules by trying to defund us, by making it harder for us to collect the dues from our members.
And this is something that you guys, that's negotiated. So basically what they're doing is they're going to make a voluntary negotiated point illegal.
Exactly. For a group that says they believe in limited government and the free market, they sure have a way of trying to rig the free market. And basically what's happening, they don't agree with what we've negotiated, so they want to change the rules. This is a collectively bargained part of a contract, and you know it's a bargaining. So management gets something for that. There's a management rights clause in the contract. You know, we pay more on health care or whatever it is we give up or change, or you know, every time you know these things can be bargained, and you know, not every union or political subdivision has things like agency shop or political deductions. Those are negotiated as well. People certainly can, put them on the table, take them off the table, do whatever they want.
But that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Why would you give up a bargaining chip?
Exactly. And what they're doing is they're interfering in the free market. The very thing they claim to protect, they want, is a free market. Well, free market means individuals get to bargain for, and organizations get to bargain for services and goods. So we're there. We're saying, okay, Mr. Employer, we'll increase your productivity. We'll do our job every day. We'll do it well. And by the way, we're going to have a union, and we want these dues deducted. And by, you know, when you get down to it, the paycheck is the property of the person.
Right.
They say it's a state paycheck, but it's not a state pay. It's a personal paycheck. It'd be like saying the bank owns your paycheck, or I guess they might, but. You know, like U.S. Steel owns your paycheck. You work those 40 hours, that's your money.
Right. Right?
That's not their money any longer. And you can choose if you want to give a PAC contribution, a United Way contribution, a deduction to your credit union, supplemental health insurance, make your car payment. And, you know, then they say, well, we take that money and use it to educate our members about politics. Well, who's to say that car, that Ford Finance or GMC Finance doesn't take that money and lobby against Dodd-Frank, or lobby for the restrictions that they may be part of ALEC, right? Who knows that the very groups that are taking our money out of our paychecks may be using that very money without their shareholders' knowledge to play in politics right here in PA.
Yeah, I look at this, and you know, I love the names. I love the names that they come up with this stuff, though, Rick. Paycheck protection, and I keep asking, where's the protection? Does it stop wage theft? Does it stop the theft of overtime? Does it stop any of the things that we've seen that I think you would need protection from? Because, you know, I don't see a cost in this. I know they keep saying that this is, you know, hugely expensive for the state and for taxpayers. So on two fronts, one, is it hugely costly? I mean, how much money are we talking about? How much money as a taxpayer am I paying for this service?
Well, you know, first of all, they're the ones who claim the cost of money, so they should be the ones asking the state how much does it cost. But as a matter of fact, the state can't even, it's so little that they can't even quantify it. And, you know, in the last contract, the union negotiated that everybody would have direct deposit. Well, that means they just saved the Commonwealth, not the state of Pennsylvania, probably $4 million just in postage for not having, they didn't have to mail paychecks or print out the paper paychecks to leave them on people's desks. So by doing that, they've easily saved the Commonwealth much more than this would cost in probably 100 years.
So
is so minuscule.
So then let me get this. It doesn't cost anything really. It would probably cost more to find out how much it costs than it actually costs.
Exactly.
It doesn't protect anything, so there's really no protection there. It's not going to stop wage theft or overtime theft or any of that stuff. And it's not doing what they said. So what is it doing?
Well, again, their attempt is here to silence workers' voices. That's what they're trying to do. They're
and who
trying
are
to
these
make
people?
Sure that we don't have the money to lobby on behalf of workers, to fight for workers. That's what they're trying to do. If this was really about cost, they would say, let's ban all deductions, United Way, Aflac, banks, United Way, and Community Chest, and all those other. If there's a cost and they say, well, the state shouldn't be picking winners and losers, well, okay, ban them all. But of course they won't do that because people want to make choices what
right.
to do with their paychecks. And they make a choice when they join a union to have their dues deducted, just like they make a choice to have a United Way deduction. So, you know, this is, it's really about, and plus, you know, they've tried to separate different unions from other unions. So if it's really about the cost, why some unions and not others? It's really about the people they like and the people they don't like.
Right. Well, like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, singling out the public sector workers, but not the firefighters and the cops. And fortunately, to their credit, the firefighters and the police, they were in with the state workers who were under attack. Because look, eventually they're on the menu as well.
And they get that. And here in PA, the labor movement has been incredibly unified about this issue. The private sector unions, who it's even a little bit more. One step removed, maybe. They know that this is the first step in trying to eliminate workers' voices, and that's why they continue to support us, stand with us, the building trades, police, fire, steel workers, industrial workers, CWA, IBEW, all of them are standing shoulder to shoulder with AFSCME and SEIU and PFT and PSEA. All the public sector, UFCW, everybody's standing together on this issue because they understand this is an attempt to silence workers' voices.
At the end of the day, this is the first step towards pushing the nonsensical right-to-work laws.
Exactly. They can weaken us here, then they can pass stuff in the legislature. If you can't win by your arguments, try to take away the money from the other side.
Right.
But you know what? We have members, and whether we have the money or not, we're going to continue to fight. You know, we'll fight a lot better if we have a little bit of resources to do that with, and we continue to have our be able to negotiate for dues deduction. But we'll never stop fighting for workers.
Yeah, I go back to
what we do.
I go back to this thing that the Commonwealth Foundation put out, this Tea Party think tank in Harrisburg. It was called Project Goliath, and I remember talking about it. It was about a year ago.
Yeah.
Where they were trying to raise several million dollars so that they could take on the AFSCME and the public sector workers, you know, the teachers, the cops, the firefighters, so that they could attack them. And I remember at the time on this program saying, look, this is what the Tea Party think tank is doing. They're going to Wall Street. They're going to the Koch brothers. They're going to these billionaires and say, hey, give us some money so we can attack these workers. And, well, here we are.
That's exactly what they're doing. Like I said, these guys have decided. They look around the country. They see one state where we got a Republican governor, House and Senate, and they haven't been able to accomplish their right-wing agenda. But that's because we in the labor movement don't support one party over another. We support people who support us. And for many, many years, we've supported both Republicans and Democrats who support workers. And those Republicans and Democrats, they know what this is. They know it's an attack to silence workers, and they're standing with us. We will have some solid Republican support as well as solid Democratic support on this issue.
Let me ask you this, Rick. You know, last line of questioning. You know, because I look at Governor Corbett's record, and it is pathetic. I can't think of another word. Disastrous, horrible, pathetic, all of that. How much of this is a distraction away from his deplorable and despicable record? How much of this is the shiny thing to keep us focused on fighting this and not fighting that horrible record that gutted billions of dollars from education, that defunded our infrastructure, that stole money from the general assistance budget, and health and human services, all of these horrible things that he's done? How much of this is part of that?
Well, it's certainly going to make, maybe fire up his base. It certainly fired our folks up. But we're not going to take our eye off the ball. We know that it is a distraction. We should be creating jobs. We should be passing legislation that makes it easier for kids to get trained for manufacturing jobs and the skill sets they need. And we need manufacturers to come back to America. And Governor Corbett should be fighting for that instead of wasting their time trying to defund the labor movement because they got a couple of non-job related issues that we've been able to stop. And you know, he needs to focus on job creation. I mean, I think we were one of the worst. I mean, our unemployment number went down, but that's because the number of workers actually out there looking for work declined. And, you know, we've got a real problem here in this economy. And focusing on this takes away from everybody's ability to make sure that we create jobs. That's what we should be doing. We should be creating jobs, not fighting over silly things.
Like, I'm right
well,
there
it's
with
not
you.
Silly to us. It's their attempt to, you know, defund us and put us out of business. So, but it is a distraction. We should be focused on other things. But we're going to fight for this, and as a result, we'll be able to fight for other things.
Tomorrow, 10 a.m., Capitol Rotunda.
Exactly. Thank you very much for all the great work you do, Rick.
I appreciate it. Rick, tomorrow, 10 a.m., we will be there, and hopefully a bunch of our listeners will come out as well. Thanks so much. I appreciate the time.
Okay, thank you.
Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. We're going to come back, talk a little bit about this. Your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Here's a jarring headline. Economic populism is a dead end for Democrats. That's the title on a recent op-ed piece written by a couple of longtime political flacks for Wall Street and published, naturally, in the Wall Street Journal. When the barons of big money start rolling out such scolding screeds, it's not because they really think populism is a loser, but because they're terrified by the fact that it has already gained mass appeal and is on the move all across grassroots America. Indeed, to put a thin veneer of legitimacy on this op-ed, they had to resort to the fiction that it is a political warning written to Democrats by Democrats, specifically by an inside-the-beltway outfit calling itself Third Way. But this group is to authentic Democratic Party principles what near beer is to stout, only not as close. Third Way is just the same old Wall Street way. While it wears a Democratic mask, it pushes for policies that are Wall Street wet dreams, including gutting and privatizing Social Security. Why would a group wanting you to believe that it has genuine Democratic genes be an advocate for further enriching Wall Street's Republican elite at the expense of America's middle class and the poor? To find out, just peek behind Third Way's organizational curtain. You'll see that its funders and governing board include no one from labor, senior citizens, consumers, environmentalists, small farmers, students, African Americans, Latinos, and other core Democratic constituencies. Instead, of its 29 board members, 20 are Wall Street bankers, hedge fund hucksters, or venture capital vultures. This is Jim Hightower saying, Third Way dead ends at Wall Street. So, fronting for the selfish interests of its backers, it doesn't want any party championing economic populism. But the people do, and that's who Democrats should heed.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The legislation we were talking about, this House Bill 1507 and Senate Bill 1034, what the ALEC people euphemistically call paycheck protection. And as I've said a number of times, no protection there. What this is and it's almost mind-boggling if you think about it. We're going to take away one of our opportunities to negotiate. We're going to take a bargaining chip away from ourselves just to punish you. And this is purely political. This has nothing to do with the taxpayer. This has nothing to do with good governance. This has nothing to do with any of that. This is purely Machiavellian politic. This is most certainly, I'm going to take my political enemy out in the square, and I'm going to gut them in public so that no one will ever dare screw with me again. That's what the billionaire class wants. And you look at this past weekend, I can't imagine how much money was pledged to destroying those institutions that built the middle class. I can't imagine how much money was thrown in by these really, really extraordinarily wealthy people that we've created. And this is the part that just drives me insane. All of the work that you and me and every one of us do, they've benefited from. And I love the, well, you got, you know, a paycheck that we're protecting for you. I love that because, you know, the reality is you know, the brain of a rich person is under the hat of a working class person. Because it's our brains, it's our hands, it's our muscles who create their wealth. Now, they've figured out how to bring their wealth together to rig the game, and they do it very well. It's just, well, the idea is if they can quash the last, really the last group, which are union members, if they can quash that last group who generally stands up and says no, game over. They've got control. Think about here in Pennsylvania. If you didn't have a strong labor movement here, lottery privatized, liquor stores privatized, who knows what else privatized. You know, I'm looking at I got a parking ticket while I was in Harrisburg back, you know, beginning of January. And on the second day, I took the parking ticket to the post office, had it mailed in. So it was stamped. I get a letter from the parking people who have now been privatized, saying that I owe them more money because it was late. And they said, we didn't get it until such and such a day. And I go, well, do you have the postmarked envelope? Well, I don't know. I go, well, I'm obviously not paying you until you show me. Well, that doesn't matter. We didn't get the money until well after. Now, think about this for a second. It used to be 7 days you had to get the, or 7 or 10 days that you had to get the envelope. Even if you went and you did it that day, maybe it doesn't get there until 3 or 4 days. And then how long does it sit on their desk before someone opens it? These are the type of schemes that keep going on up by these profiteers. Who are the people who push back against them? Labor people. Who are the people who stand up when no one else will? Labor people. Which is why you see this push towards destroying them. And I looked at the union density numbers. I guess the union density is down to 11.3% in the country, and even lower than that in the private sector. But one of the things that caught my attention in the Department of Labor's report, Secretary Perez put out his report. It says in 2013, among full-time wage and salary workers, union members had a median usual weekly earnings of $950 per week, while those who were not union members had a median weekly earnings of $750 a week. So you're talking about a $200 difference each and every week. And what you then think about is this push by the very, very powerful, the wealthy and powerful, to push this right-to-work stuff. What I found interesting is Politico came out with, I don't know if you saw this at Politico, they came out with a ranking of all 50 states on a combination of, you know, a whole bunch of different quality of life, high school graduation rates, per capita income, life expectancy, crime rate, you know, all those things that they threw in. And then they averaged it out over, you know, these 14 criteria, and they came up with a list. And what's interesting is the outcome of this is that four of the five best states to live in are states that are non-right-to-work states. Places like New Hampshire, Minnesota, Vermont, Utah, and Massachusetts, those are the top five. The worst states, the bottom five, right-to-work states, Alabama, Tennessee, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi. And you go through and you look at the bottom 20 of the 50 states, right-to-work states. So you're looking at the bottom half of the economic scale are where all of the right-to-work states are. And yet we've got people here saying we should be pursuing that course of action here in Pennsylvania. And you go, explain to me why we would do that. Why would we be pushing something that we know is destructive? Well, because the very well-to-do want it. Now, understand, Pennsylvania has the fourth highest number of union members in the country, which is why this is another one of those prime moments for the Koch brothers, and one of those prime moments for the very well, the Wall Street crowd, the big, huge multinational corporations. Because if you can quash that, you can make people desperate enough, and you do away with the social safety net, and you take away avenues like unemployment insurance to hold on for better wages. Understand, all of this downward pressure is to deflate wages. That's all it's about. And you may be okay right now, but understand, all of us are in this. So if you allow the teachers and the cops and the firefighters and the people who plow the snow and pick up the trash and do all the state corrections officers and all of, you allow all of those people to have their wages suppressed and held down, what happens to you?
Well, I won't have to pay any taxes.
Wrong. Wrong, 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 wrong. What happens to you is your wages keep going down because there's downward pressure across the spectrum. It's what we've been seeing since 2007 in the recession. We've seen a labor market that's full of people, And we've seen huge amounts of money going to these big companies and huge amounts of money going to the so-called job creators. And what have they done? They haven't hired people. So tomorrow night when the State of the Union goes on, we're going to hear the president probably going to talk about income inequality, probably going to talk about raising the minimum wage a little bit. Probably talk a little bit about how we dabble around the edges. What we really need is a bold, passionate speech to say, you know what? We need to be fighting back against the moneyed interests. It's these people pushing this poison who are destroying this country. This anti-American view that we can screw people where they spend a third of their lives and steal from them and all of this and still have something called freedom? Really? It leaves me scratching my head. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Here's a jarring headline. Economic populism is a dead end for Democrats. That's the title on a recent op-ed piece written by a couple of longtime political flacks for Wall Street and published, naturally, in the Wall Street Journal. When the barons of big money start rolling out such scolding screeds, it's not because they really think populism is a loser, but because they're terrified by the fact that it has already gained mass appeal and is on the move all across grassroots America. Indeed, to put a thin veneer of legitimacy on this op-ed, they had to resort to the fiction that it is a political warning written to Democrats by Democrats, specifically by an Inside the Beltway outfit calling itself Third Way. But this group is to authentic Democratic Party principles what near beer is to stout, only not as close. Third Way is just the same old Wall Street way. While it wears a Democratic mask, it pushes for policies that are Wall Street wet dreams, including gutting and privatizing Social Security. Why would a group wanting you to believe that it has genuine Democratic genes be an advocate for further enriching Wall Street's Republican elite at the expense of America's middle class and the poor? To find out, just peek behind Third Way's organizational curtain. You will see that its funders and governing board include no one from labor, senior citizens, consumers, environmentalists, small farmers, students, African Americans, Latinos, and other core Democratic constituencies. Instead, of its 29 board members, 20 are Wall Street bankers, hedge fund hucksters, or venture capital vultures. This is Jim Hightower saying, Third Way dead ends at Wall Street. So, fronting for the selfish interests of its backers, it doesn't want any party championing economic populism. But the people do, and that's who Democrats should heed.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So I don't know if you saw this statement in the Wall Street Journal. A venture capitalist, a guy named Thomas Perkins, evidently wrote a letter to the editor there in the W SJ, Wall Street Journal, called some... I can't even pronounce it, to be honest with you. And it's one of these things where you go, really? Kristallt? Progressive Kristallt coming? He's asking the question. He said, I would call attention to the parallels of fascist Nazi Germany to its war on 1%, namely its Jews, to the progressive war on American 1%, namely the rich. Now, Mr. Perkins is one of the founders of the venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers. Saying that, you know, talking about taxing the rich, you know, the really super rich, is just like, you know, the slaughter of millions of Jews during the Holocaust. Same thing. And I guess if you really sit and you think about it, sure, why not? Yeah, I mean, the words, you know, that, you know, the super well-to-do should pay their taxes. Wow. That must really sting. Much, much worse than the gas. I'm sure. Much, much worse. I don't even know what to say with that. I mean, you look at this, and here's a guy who's mega wealthy. And I guess it comes back. I think about my uncle, who's a very well-to-do guy who actually seems kind of hurt that people would say that he should be paying more taxes. Not remembering that during his lifetime, the top marginal tax rate was 92%. And now it's at historic lows. And I think the very well-to-do in the country seem to have this very patriarchal view of society. That, you know, they'll do their charity events and they'll do their things. As long as they get pat on the back, get some recognition, gotta have that. But if you question them, then, well, that's where we draw the line. So basically what we're talking about is these benevolent little dictators who get their panties in a wad when you begin to say, hey, wait a second. Instead of me begging for you, maybe we should be able to work for it and earn a decent living. And, you know, I don't know, all the things that you benefit from, maybe you should have to pay for that. I think of my uncle, and I think of all the infrastructure that's gone into the business that he has. And look, he worked hard all of his life. He deserves to be well off. But there's a point at which you go, I've seen. And, you know, when you have the conversation, most of the money that he made were from government contracts. And, you know, is there this, really, I mean, is there this disconnect from people who have made a lot of money, but made it because we, the taxpayers, said, you know what, we're going to invest in something and we need somebody to do it. And they were lucky enough to have the connections to be able to do it. And that's, you know, at the end of it, where a lot of this goes. It comes down to the politic. I mean, look at what happened to Wall Street. Look at when the economy was in free fall. Look at the collapse that was happening. We went with checkbook wide open, as much as you want. Here you go, 1%. Here you go, Wall Street. If I remember, it was Bernanke who said, we're going to do whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. And I remember this. To me, that sounds like, hey, my ears would perk up, go, what? Whatever it takes? Are you sure? Well, that check better be mighty big. And it was, $750 billion. And what did these guys do? Well, they enriched themselves. They put it in their pockets. The biggest heist in the history of civilization happened right before Eisen. Nobody ever talks about it. You know, Obama came into office. Worst collapse in my lifetime. Worst economy in my lifetime. Worst economy in probably the majority of people who were alive at the time. Worst times ever. Yet, when he mentions it, the right beats him up. Oh, you're just Bush passing. And when you look at, I love the meritocracy argument. CEOs make all this money because they're really bright guys. And they make their companies a lot of money. So Jane sent me this article about Jamie Dimon, the head of JP Morgan Chase, who evidently after all of the penalties and all of the things that have gone on, if you remember the London Whale case, I forget what it was, like $20 billion that they had to pay out in fines. Evidently, Jamie Dimon is getting a raise, a 74% raise. And you go, are you kidding me? A 74% raise? And at what point do we go, these are the people who perpetrated the biggest heist in the history of civilization, and they're the ones who are walking away with huge amounts of money? I guess like something like $20 million? How can you defend that? How can anyone defend that? How can anyone possibly look at this and go, oh, well, you know, hey, he works hard. You know what? So does the plumber. You know what? So does the guy who put my floor in. But the difference is those guys, they don't have the opportunity to set up offshore accounts. They don't have the ability to shelter their money from taxes. Well, our friends in big business do. And I was reading an article over at Bloomberg today that pointed out that, you know, back in 2004, Congress had passed a law that it was supposed to penalize these CEOs who leave the country. You know, they change their legal address for tax purposes. They go like to Ireland or the Cayman Islands or somewhere. Like, there was supposed to be a penalty to there. And what they found out is, duh, it hasn't worked because they left a massive gaping loophole through it, as they do. And I'm sure as was negotiated. I'm sure, look, you know, during the Bush years, you were not going to get anything to hold business accountable. They bought that seat. They got what they wanted. But it looked good. Oh, we're going to try and do it. And you look at the huge amounts of money that have fled this country since 2004. And basically what they did, this colossal failure, basically what they did is they took the money and they handed it out to their shareholders. They moved to these no tax areas and they just handed the money out, which evidently was the loophole that you could use to avoid paying U.S. taxes. And you know, it makes me, I look back at this and I go, you know, I remember them debating this, and I remember at the time people saying this isn't going to work. Maybe we should be looking at something else. And I look at this and I go, you know, at some point, don't we the consumers, don't we the people have to be holding these people accountable? And I guess it comes with information. I don't know. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, that's where the podcast will be. Stitcher on the smartphone. You send me an email, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Let's take a quick break. Right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
A broad coalition, including labor, farm, internet, and environmental groups, are in the midst of a 10-days to stop fast-track movement against the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement. Hundreds of organizations are protesting the secret negotiations that will produce the TPP-NAFTA-style trade agreement. The Obama administration is pursuing fast-track authority to try and take the TPP straight from corporate-dominated secret creation sessions to a congressional vote. with no chance to debate or amend the deal. Melinda St. Louis with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch says agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership are bad for workers, bad for the environment, and threaten the ability of the U.S. to enforce environmental regulations. And she says 20 years of data on NAFTA has convinced economists across the board that these deals are raw deals for all but the corporate elite.
The reality is that economists across all stripes, even those who have supported these types of trade agreements in the past, all admit this model of trade agreement is a major contributor to income inequality, to the increase in inequality among Americans.
St. Louis says support of the TPP puts Obama at odds with his stated goal of addressing income inequality.
Among the Obama's base, there is massive opposition. In his own party, this is not something that is popular at all, including in the leadership. And so if he does choose to, in the State of the Union address this coming Tuesday, if he chooses to push for fast track, he will be at odds with the vast majority of his party, and unfortunately will be undermining his stated legacy issue of trying to combat income inequality.
Public Citizen is urging people to call Congress opposing fast track authority for the TPP. Efforts to raise the minimum wage are underway in 30 U.S. states, from Alabama and Alaska to Florida, New Hampshire, Idaho, and many states in between. Democrats are pushing these efforts to raise state minimum wages. The highest minimum wage proposal is in Massachusetts, where the measure would raise it to $11 over 3 years. States can raise their minimum wages above the federal level of $7.25 an hour. Democrats support raising the wages. Republicans generally oppose it. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, unions added 162,000 new members in 2013. Private sector union ranks actually grew by 281,000 workers, but losses of 118,000 union workers from the public sector kept the net gain to 162,000. The overall percentage of American workers in unions held steady at 11.3%. The Department of Labor says union workers have higher median wages, $950 a week, compared to $750 for non-union workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So last Monday, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a case called Harris v. Quinn, where a number of home health care workers said, we don't want to have to pay fair share dues. We want all of the benefits. We want what they get. We want to make sure that we get paid and we get all the things that they get, but we don't want to have to pay for it. And this, again, another one of those well-funded attacks by the National Right to Work people, the Koch brother people, the DeVosses, our billionaire class. And as I'm looking at this, this has the ability to affect tens of thousands of people across this country who desperately need a voice, especially when you're talking about home health care workers who are really at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder and need this kind of organization and voice, which is why, again, you can't allow them to rise up, because then the wealthy folks in the country, not just wealthy, that upper echelon, the Kochs and such, the people who were in Palm Springs over the weekend raising money for more attack dog type stuff. But anyway, I've asked Steve Edelston. He's a national policy director at the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute to come talk to us. They have filed an amicus brief in this Harris versus Quinn. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me back.
So explain to me what this is about. I understand, a couple of members, that they don't want to pay fair share dues. Does it go further than that?
Well, for this particular case, it's about these home care workers who are part of a Medicaid-funded consumer-directed program. Don't want to pay the fair share dues. But obviously it calls into question, the union's right to, organize public employees. So, it could be much larger than just this particular program in Illinois, and, that's the concern.
So basically, it could affect people here in Pennsylvania and across the country by you know, I guess making it illegal for them to organize.
It would make it if they were to overturn the Abu decision, which gave public employees the right to organize and allowed for fair share. It would call into question the union's representation of public employees.
So it's not just Illinois that's affected; it could be everyone. Walk me through the argument that you guys made on Monday.
Sure. So we filed an amicus in this case. Our organization focuses on the direct care workforce and health care workers. And the fact of the matter is that while this is a very large and fast growing occupation, the conditions of employment are not very good. The wages are low. There's often not health insurance. Access to training is variable. And so, as a result, retention of workers in this field is very hard. And as our population is aging, the baby boomers turning 65, over the next decade, our need for these kinds of workers is just going to continue to grow. So our view is that, state governments who are charged with providing these services should have the flexibility to take directions that they feel will strengthen the workforce. And the fact of the matter is that one of the things that correlates with higher wages, correlates with the opportunity to get health coverage for home care workers is having union representation. So it makes sense for governments to think about this approach as something that they might offer to their workers, so that they can ensure that they have a workforce that's large enough and stable enough to meet the demand for these essential services.
It's always amazed me that and I've talked to a number of home health care workers over the years, and it's amazed me that these are the people that we've entrusted are one of our most valuable resources, our seniors, to, and our disabled folks and all of that. And yet these are people who they themselves often cannot go see a doctor or get any type of medical treatment. It seems to me to be kind of twisted.
Well, it's true. And, the figures are nationally 40% of the home care, of the direct care workforce rely on some form of public benefit to make ends meet. So, here's a workforce that, caring for our elders, caring for people with disabilities, allowing family members to be able to go to work, support themselves and their family, and they're having trouble supporting their own families.
How much special interest is behind this? I mean, we see the National Right to Work Foundation. We see, these right-wing think tanks and these groups out there. How much of this is being pushed by them?
That I can't really say, Rick, but, obviously, it's a major, political cause. We've seen, the attacks on public unions, across the country and through the Midwest, as a result of, the last election cycle. So, I don't think it's any surprise that, we're seeing, attacks through the courts as well.
Yeah, given the makeup of the Supreme Court, what are the chances of this getting out unchanged? What are the chances of things staying the same, as opposed to being all thrown into chaos?
It's anybody's guess, but certainly there's well established precedent for these kinds of arrangements, and we've got to hope that that the Supreme Court. Reliance on precedent, which it does very often, carry the day.
Hoping that John Roberts calls balls and strikes, like he didn't do with Citizens United. So what are the options here? I mean, there are a couple of different options the court could have. What are they?
Well, I mean, you know, they could take any number of approaches. They, you know, they could rule narrowly, you know, on the facts of this case. They could do something, you know, very broad in terms of overturning the entire precedent, and sort of anywhere in between. So it really will depend upon, you know, where the majority lines up, you know, how they can get enough votes to get a majority opinion, you know, how broad or narrow they need to go to get the five justices.
And then legislatively, is there anything to do? Because at the end of this, this could be really injurious to all of these, you know, these tens of thousands of home health care workers across the country. I mean, this could be a huge, major step backward.
Well, absolutely. And you know, the last time I was on, we were talking about extending minimum wage and overtime protection to this workforce, which the Department of Labor finally announced this past October. And to think, you know, now, these few months later, we're now discussing this case, which has, you know, really could be a major step backward after we finally won that important victory last fall.
And the thing that gets me is what happens to, you know, let's say this goes the wrong way and, you know, people then begin to lose the benefits that maybe they've fought for over these last several months and years. You know, what, again, what kind of a workforce do you end up with? How unstable and what does it cost us down the road? Because then you end up with more folks into nursing care, into institutional care. It just seems to me to be, from a societal standpoint, Steve, it's something that could be very chaotic.
Absolutely. You know, it really makes no economic sense whatsoever. You know, trying to provide these services, you know, without taking care of the workforce is really just not possible. We won't be able to attract workers into this field. You know, we're going to need over a million new home care workers in the next 10 years. And that's just to keep up with the new demand for services. But if we're losing these workers to other jobs because, you know, they don't match up compared to other opportunities, you know, we're going to need even more than that. So if we don't take care of these workers and we don't provide them with a living wage and access to health coverage and all the kinds of things that, you know, anyone would want from a good job, we're just not going to have the care there when we want it. And, you know, everybody wants to be taken care of at home, but it's just not going to be an option because there won't be the workers there available to do it.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you're in a situation where, you know, how can you afford to live on some of the wages, especially before the minimum wage announcement? I mean, because I were talking to people who, you know, they were there all the time, and there were no caps on hours, or they were outside of the Fair Labor Standards Act. They basically had no rights. They were kind of in limbo.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, the sad truth is that, you know, the wages in this field are so low that, you know, raising the minimum wage often, you know, provides a raise for a significant chunk of this workforce. So, you know, we're not doing very much in terms of investing in a workforce that to meet up with the demand that, you know, coming down the road, we can see it coming as our country ages.
Now, are you seeing any push towards pushing a minimum wage? I know there are a number of states across the country that are looking to do that. Anything on the federal level? Do you think the president will bring it up tomorrow in the State of the Union?
I expect he will, and certainly we've heard it in a number of states, you know, it does seem very timely, considering, you know, how long it's been.
How long is it going to take till this announcement comes? I put very little hope in anything coming out of the Supreme Court. Whenever the Chamber of Commerce does anything with the court, the one statistic I saw said they had like a 74% rate of winning cases where they've put their name on it. So I'm not very hopeful.
It'll be several months away before we hear anything on this. Well, likely not until the summer.
Well, when that comes out, we'd love to have you come back and analyze it, tell us what it's about and where it's going and all of that.
I'd be happy to do it.
Steve, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Good talking with you. Take care now.
Steve Edelson, he is a paraprofessional healthcare institute national policy director. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Here's a jarring headline. Economic populism is a dead end for Democrats. That's the title on a recent op-ed piece written by a couple of longtime political flacks for Wall Street and published, naturally, in the Wall Street Journal. When the barons of big money start rolling out such scolding screeds, it's not because they really think populism is a loser, but because they're terrified by the fact that it has already gained mass appeal and is on the move all across grassroots America. Indeed, to put a thin veneer of legitimacy on this op-ed, they had to resort to the fiction that it is a political warning written to Democrats by Democrats, specifically by an inside-the-beltway outfit calling itself Third Way. But this group is to authentic Democratic Party principles what near beer is to stout, only not as close. Third Way is just the same old Wall Street way. While it wears a Democratic mask, it pushes for policies that are Wall Street wet dreams, including gutting and privatizing Social Security. Why would a group wanting you to believe that it has genuine Democratic genes be an advocate for further enriching Wall Street's Republican elite at the expense of America's middle class and the poor? To find out, just peek behind Third Way's organizational curtain. You'll see that its funders and governing board include no one from labor, senior citizens, consumers, environmentalists, small farmers, students, African Americans, Latinos, and other core Democratic constituencies. Instead, of its 29 board members, 20 are Wall Street bankers, hedge fund hucksters, or venture capital vultures. This is Jim Hightower saying, Third Way dead ends at Wall Street. So, fronting for the selfish interests of its backers, it doesn't want any party championing economic populism. But the people do, and that's who Democrats should heed.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? Time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So Bill sent me this during the break. And again, you can email me, Rick at therickssmithshow.com. He says, help me with this. Please, I need this explained. He said, the South is home to 9 of the nation's 10 poorest states. The South is rabidly against government spending. Yet the South gets far more in government subsidies than they give back in taxes. In short, he says, conservative states are welfare states that benefit from the tax-paying blue states. As it turns out, he says, liberals have been supporting conservatives financially this whole time and not the other way around. He says that means conservative states are parasites even while they accuse liberal states of being lazy. Yeah, you're right. I've often said, the person who's, with their biggest flaws, They're the ones who look for it in everyone else. So when you see someone pointing their finger, and the old man always said, if you point your finger at somebody, you got three pointing back at you. It made sense. So, you know, you're going to project your flaw, your weakness on others. You know, if you're lazy, you're going to say, oh, they're lazy, and you're going to do it louder than everyone else. If you're stupid, well, same kind of thing. The combination of both, well, there you go. There's conservatism at its core. So, you know, that's, yeah, the facts are there, the numbers are there. What's interesting to me, and I guess it's just because we're blinded by all of our divides, and we've been sliced and diced and separated and subcategorized and all of that, that the people who would benefit, and I just spent the last couple of days in D.C. talking about the health care law, which, you know, it's going to take a couple of years before we find out what it's going to do. It's going to take some time. But indications early look, it's doing something, something positive. So that's a step in the right direction. But it's going to be several years down the road before we actually know if this is where we're going to go. I just found it so interesting in talking to people while I was there, that not for the conference, but for other things in D.C., that, you know, they all point to the South and they go, what is it about these areas where they have really extraordinarily high poverty rates, yet they adamantly refuse to support Obamacare? But when you throw out the Affordable Care Act, it kind of changes a little bit. And one of the guys we talked to from Tennessee, you know, he's saying, you know, most of the people in the legislature and most of the people in the Congress are rabidly opposed to it. But if you get down into where the people actually live, and this is kind of where the disconnect for me is, he says, you get down to where the people actually live and they want the health care. But they've been told that it's so bad by these people that they elected and people that they trust. And it's this weird, bizarre dynamic where the people that they trust that they've elected are the ones who are really sticking it to them. And why? Well, because they're generally the moneyed interests. So I'm just looking at this, and I, you know, because to me, everything comes back down to the money. All of the talk of religion, all of the talk of values, all of the talk of, oh, we love the children, and oh, we care about marriage, and oh, we love all. Those are distractions. They throw that red meat out there and go, here, go ahead, fight over this while we pilfer from all of you. Until we figure out how to stop, we're going to continue to be poor. And that's the reality. And I hear people, you know, saying to me, well, isn't that divide and conquer? Look, I care about people who work for a living. The Koch brothers and the Warren Buffetts and the Gates and all of them, they are going to be just fine. They're going to be able to buy whoever they want. I care about the guy who, you know, I care about this family that drops their kid off, their infant off with my wife because they don't have any other option. Because they both have to work. I care about any family. I mean, I thought about that all day today. I cannot fathom what it must be like. And yet it's the reality for millions in this country. You know, we hear all of this nonsense about, oh, we care about the family. Oh, we care about family values. Oh, we care about the children. Yet I don't see the policy. I don't see the legislation. I don't see the political will. I just don't see it. Now, tomorrow, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. at the Capitol Rotunda, there's going to be a press conference. And it's very simple. To me, this is another one of those pegs. It's like a big game of that Jenga thing. It's another one of those things that gets pulled out from under us. Another thing that they take away. You know, they take away, they freeze unemployment benefits. They cut, you know, the food stamp program. They cut LIHEAP. They cut all these little death of a thousand paper cuts. All bringing down the middle class, bringing down the working class of this country. bit by bit, step by step. Little bit here, and all down. You know, when you've got our purchased wing of the Republican Party out there attacking teachers, out there attacking nurses and firemen and cops and going after them saying, well, you know, we can't let you do this, we can't let you enter into an agreement with your employer. Just can't do that. It's horrible. So we're going to help protect your paycheck. But it's not going to actually protect anything. No. No, we're not going to stop your employer from possibly cheating you out of wages. No, that's not in that, no. But we're going to call it something that it's not. And for me, what this is more of the distraction, more of the, you know, hey, they have something you don't. They get something you don't. And it's more divide and conquer. And, you know, I keep going back to this because, you know, at some point, eventually, we realize that all of these attacks over the last 20, 30 years, ever since the Reagan Revolution, all of this movement toward a corporate state is harmful to all of us. You know, I go back and I think about when I started working. I remember my first job, my first real job. I had a bunch of, you know, small jobs that were, you know, I'm only in this until I go back to school kind of things. But when I realized that this is what I'm doing for a living, I remember going, wow, I'm making like, you know, 15 bucks an hour back in the late 80s. Going, wow, this is good. And I knew every year, because they had a contract, every year I was going to get, you know, like a nickel or 15 cents or whatever the raise was. And that there was an opportunity to negotiate and say, hey, if the company does well, if we work hard, we make them money, we're going to get some of that back. That, you know, at that time being, you know, 20, I remember going, wow, that's pretty freaking incredible. When I look at the last 10 years, where you go, there just hasn't been any of those, at least since 2007, there have been no raises for working people. Nothing. And where's the profit gone? Where's the wealth gone? Well, we know where it's gone. And it hasn't been to the people who made it. You know, there was a place I used to work. I spent 19 years there. The company got themselves into huge trouble. Because one company bought another, overpaid for it, then bought another and overpaid for it, got themselves into huge debt. The recession hit, huge debt. Now they keep going back to their workforce, going, yeah, we screwed up. Give us more back. Give us more back. Give us more back. And every time you turn around, there's, hey, we want more. Hey, we want more. Because we've got to pay homage to the bondholders. We've got to pay homage to the financiers. And I really thought, and again, I've thought this a couple of times, that the company was going to go out of business. And I've always thought that the right-wing message machine will do what they did with Hostess and point the finger at the people who had no choice in this, the workers. It was horrible management decision. It was horrible management policy. It was just bad business. And it always seems to be the workers who bail them out. Amazing stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
A union man from the firefighters, my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, a union town.
that united we bargain, divided we beg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
A broad coalition, including labor, farm, internet, and environmental groups, are in the midst of a 10-days to stop fast-track movement against the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement. Hundreds of organizations are protesting the secret negotiations that will produce the TPP-NAFTA-style trade agreement. The Obama administration is pursuing fast-track authority to try and take the TPP straight from corporate-dominated secret creation sessions to a congressional vote, with no chance to debate or amend the deal. Melinda St. Louis with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch says agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership are bad for workers, bad for the environment, and threaten the ability of the U.S. to enforce environmental regulations. And she says 20 years of data on NAFTA has convinced economists across the board that these deals are raw deals for all but the corporate elite.
The reality is that economists across all stripes, even those who have supported these types of trade agreements in the past, all admit this model of trade agreement is a major contributor to income inequality, to the increase in inequality among Americans.
St. Louis says support of the TPP puts Obama at odds with his stated goal of addressing income inequality.
Among the Obama's base, there is massive opposition. In his own party, this is not something that is popular at all, including in the leadership. And so if he does choose to, in the State of the Union address this coming Tuesday, if he chooses to push for fast track, he will be at odds with the vast majority of his party, and unfortunately will be undermining his stated legacy issue of trying to combat income inequality.
Public Citizen is urging people to call Congress opposing fast track authority for the TPP. Efforts to raise the minimum wage are underway in 30 U.S. states, from Alabama and Alaska to Florida, New Hampshire, Idaho, and many states in between. Democrats are pushing these efforts to raise state minimum wages. The highest minimum wage proposal is in Massachusetts, where the measure would raise it to $11 over 3 years. States can raise their minimum wages above the federal level of $7.25 an hour. Democrats support raising the wages. Republicans generally oppose it. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, unions added 162,000 new members in 2013. Private sector union ranks actually grew by 281,000 workers, but losses of 118,000 union workers from the public sector kept the net gain to 162,000. The overall percentage of American workers in unions held steady at 11.3%. The Department of Labor says union workers have higher median wages, $950 a week, compared to $750 for non-union workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
It was an inside job. Rather well connected. Your little protest. No family rejection.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So for Mondays, for the next several Mondays, a number of groups will be focusing on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, under the heading of Stand Up to ALEC. Their website, standuptoalec.org, where every Monday you can go and find a new topic to see what ALEC, what poison ALEC is pushing, and maybe even who's behind it. Which is why we have asked Brendan Fisher, general counsel and reporter for the Center for Media and Democracy, to come talk with us about this first ALEC Monday on inequality and wage and lack of wages. Brendan, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for having me back.
You know, I look at this wage and income inequality, something I think the president might touch on a bit tomorrow in the State of the Union address. But something that is really grossly needed to be talked about.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I know one of the things that President Obama is going to push for tomorrow is an increase in the federal minimum wage. It's long overdue. It's something that has not changed for far too long. But you have seen a lot of different states and local governments trying to take action in the face of inaction at the federal level. And in response to that, Alec and his corporate members have really been trying to push back. So one of the bills that they've been pushing for a long time is this preemption of the Living Wage Mandate Act, which basically tells local governments or city governments that you can't increase your minimum wage. It's basically, you know, and that goes against these conservative ideas of local control, that
right.
local government is better, that power is best kept close to the people. So if a local government, if a city or a county decides that they want their workers paid well, Alec is going to swoop in and say that you can't do that. They've got similar bills too to do the same with paid sick days. And I think in Pennsylvania right now, you all are considering a bill basically that could be tied back to Alec that would prevent any local government from enacting a paid sick day ordinance.
Yeah, that would be House Bill 1960 put forth by Republican Representative Seth Grove.
Yeah, that's right. Seth Grove is an Alec member. And you've really seen these bills, these paid sick day preemption bills, sweep across the country since August 2011 when a bill was shared at the Alec meeting. You've seen it become law introduced in 14 states, become law in at least eight states. In most cases, these bills are getting introduced by Alec members. And this is, you know, this is common sense legislation. If you're sick, especially if you work in the food service industry, you should not be going to work. You should have the right to be able to stay home. If your kid's sick, you should be able to stay home with your kid without having to worry about losing pay or losing your job. And of course, Alec and his corporate backers like the National Restaurant Association don't want to see that happen. So you've been seeing these bills and many other bills introduced to basically exacerbate the severe income inequality that we're seeing in the country.
What do you say to those who say that income inequality isn't all that bad? That if you I talked about this last week, that one of the business channels said, well, you know, it's not so bad because, you know, we've got these safety net programs that keep the bottom from falling too far. And, you know, it was really the rich people who got hurt due to the recession. They were the ones who really took the big hit. What do you say to that view that, you know, there's some inequality, but it's not really that bad?
Yeah. I mean, and that's something that Alec has pushed to. We looked at their American Legislator magazine or their American Legislator website, and they pushed the same idea through their tax publications that income inequality is not really a problem, but it is. I mean, especially when you look at who the gains have gone to over the past several decades. You've seen the vast majority of the economic gains that have been made have gone to the very top. People who are working, people who are not in the top 1% have not seen a correlative increase in their wages or in their wealth. It's really all gone to the very top. And you also haven't seen a whole lot of increase in mobility. So if you're born poor, you're going to stay poor. And there was a recent study coming out that showed how the U.S. really lags behind other countries when it comes to some economic mobility. Many European countries had much greater mobility, and you also saw a strong correlation between these European countries like Denmark that have much greater mobility. You see a strong correlation with much higher rates of unionization. And here in the U.S., as we've seen unionization decline, you've also seen inequality increase, and you've seen more of the gains go to the top 1%. And of course, as you know, and your listeners probably know, Alec has played a major role in trying to weaken unions, make it harder to unionize, try to take unions out at the knees, and they've been successful, especially over the past few years in states like Wisconsin, in Michigan, and I know they're trying to do that in Pennsylvania too, but with the right to work bill that's been introduced once again.
Yeah, I mean, you look at this, and, you know, as you pointed out, if you have that ability to bargain, you have a better shot of getting some of the wealth that you create, and you know, it's this law of preemption. They're going to go after your ability to pass any law to benefit society, and, you know, again, it goes, the people who are pushing this poison are generally the ones who are saying that we believe in local control. Yet, you know, not so much. I guess they believe in the one with the biggest purse, they control.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's also they talk about being an organization that supports small government, but what they're really trying to do is use government in order to expand profits. So the corporations that are members of ALEC are trying to use government in order to expand profits. And in some cases, that means getting government out of the way when it comes to regulation, but it also can mean getting government to intervene when you've got local elected officials who are trying to make sure that their constituents can have a fair wage and can get a day off if they're sick. It's really using the power of state legislators in order to override the power of local legislators.
So now that you're doing these Monday events, the Stand Up to ALEC .org, what kind of response did you get with today's, especially on wage and income inequality?
Yes, the response has been great, and I think we're trying to highlight the various aspects of ALEC's agenda, because they are such a wide ranging organization. They touch on people's lives in a lot of different ways. You've got the income inequality, you've got their attacks on workers, their attacks on unions, but this is also the same organization that promoted attacks on immigrant rights. They're the ones who helped spread SB 1070 in Arizona, and they're the group that tried to declare that if you're born in the U.S. and your parents are undocumented, you should not be a U.S. citizen. They're also the group that's attacked environmental standards and tried to promote climate change denial. And of course, they're also the organization that helped spread standard ground laws nationwide. And I think we're trying to get people to look beyond just the particular issue area that they may be most interested in, and recognize that these attacks are coming from the same place. They're coming from the same organization. You have to look as broadly as possible to see that a lot of our struggles in a lot of different areas are very, very much connected.
Yeah, and you look at this, and what it is it's the strong arm of the CEO boardroom. It's kind of the way I look at it. This is the pit bull that the Koch brothers and the very well-to-do in our country fund so that they go out and do their bidding.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, as we've documented at alecexposed.org and prwatch.org, ALEC is almost entirely funded by corporations. They get 98% of their funding from corporations and foundations like the Koch Family Foundation. They call themselves a membership organization, but they only get 2% of their funding from legislative membership dues. And you can follow the money. I mean, the ALEC exists in order to sell access to state legislators, sell access for corporations to state legislators. And they get funded by corporations, and corporations not only get to join ALEC, they actually get a seat at the table. They get a vote on what model legislation is going to be adopted by ALEC as official policy, and then you see that policy very much spread across the country as we've documented many times.
Yeah, I mean, right here in Pennsylvania, I mean, a lot of people think that the ugliness in Wisconsin and Ohio and other places didn't happen here, but the reality is, you look at, maybe we didn't get Stand Your Ground, but they passed the Castle Doctrine. Maybe we didn't go as far as some on attacking prevailing wage, but they still did. Maybe you look at the voter suppression law that fortunately was just struck down as unconstitutional. I mean, you can go down the list of the things that and now this the Seth Grove bill to preempt the ability of local municipalities to pay for sick days, and Denglinger's bill to so that you don't have to, so you can discriminate because of your conscience. The freedom of conscience bill, which, just mind blowing to me. But here it's all this central control, and it keeps coming back to the same big moneyed interests.
Yeah, that's right. And on top of that, you can see that these legislators are not just merely doing the bidding of ALEC, they're doing the bidding of the corporations that fund it, which happen to be the same corporations that give these politicians campaign contributions and buy their favor through gifts. Legislators are flying to these ALEC meetings on the corporate dime. The same corporations that benefit from the introduction of model legislation are paying for the flights and hotel rooms that send legislators to these meetings. While they're at these meetings, they're wined and they're dined. They're taken out to events. They're taken to the party box at Major League Baseball games. And they come back, and they're, in many cases, they're a vessel to advance the corporate agenda in Pennsylvania and in many other states.
Yeah, I just read an article in the New York Times not too long ago talking just about that, how much of this corporate money and these big fundraisers that are thrown for these politicians. And you got to ask yourself, you know, how much payback goes into that? I mean, when they have that kind of access to our legislators, when they have that kind of access to the lawmakers, how much influence? You got to think there's something there.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it works on a variety of different levels. It works on the basic fact that legislators are human. And if someone were to buy me a flight and pay for my hotel rooms, I would be inevitably going to feel some sense of gratitude. I'm going to feel indebted to the person who paid for that. And then the way politics works now, in the post-Citizens United world, even if you don't like it, you've got to play the money game. You've got to have money to run. You've got to have money to get reelected. So you end up spending more time with wealthy interests. You've got to spend more time fundraising. You're surrounded by rich people. And if you're not doing what the rich people are asking of you, you're not going to raise money, and you're probably not going to get reelected. And in that way, this income inequality that we've been talking about is very much connected with political inequality. Because we have so many people, because we have a small number of people that are increasingly holding all of the resources, and you have this post-Citizens United electoral landscape where rich people can spend as much money as they want, you've got this situation where politicians have to spend more time, more time with rich people, more time chasing the dollars that those rich people have, and politicians increasingly become less attuned to the interests of working people and normal people, and the policies follow suit. So this income inequality and political inequality is very much in decline.
So as you look at this, you know, the main thing that we should be working on is getting money out of politics.
That would make a huge difference. And you know, I think if you had money out of politics, if you had politicians who were less indebted and less attuned to the interests of corporate donors and CEOs, I'm sure you'd see an increase in the minimum wage. But getting money out of politics would be a huge step, I think, in getting the political system back in line with the interests of average Americans.
So as you move forward on ALEC Mondays, what's next week going to bring us?
You know, I don't know that off the top of my head. In the coming week, we're going to have ALEC in healthcare, their attacks on the Affordable Care Act, and other efforts to limit access to affordable health care for most Americans. We're going to have ALEC in immigration, the role that they've played in spreading SB 1070 and other anti-immigrant laws nationwide. We're going to have ALEC in civil rights, their attacks on voting, ALEC in the environment, the way that they've tried to promote climate change denialism in schools, and the way they've tried to deregulate environmental standards, and even try to discourage the use of solar energy, all to benefit big polluters like Koch Industries and BP. You know, we'll have a whole line of these, and we'll be happy to come out and talk about it more.
Yeah, so we can have our freedom water. Got to have our freedom water. Because nothing says freedom like uncontrollable vomiting. I don't know if you followed the thing in West Virginia, the little spill of Freedom Industries into American Waters water supply. Not even the people's. I mean, but because nothing says freedom like a kind of a nasty brownish yellow water substance in your bathtub.
Yeah. Well, in your privatized water supply, American Waters a privatized water company, so it's privately operated.
And that's what I said. There's nothing like freedom water. Sad stuff. Brendan, it was great talking with you, and I look forward to the ALEC Mondays going forward. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again real soon.
Yeah, it would be great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Brendan Fisher, General Counsel and Reporter for the Center for Media and Democracy. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Here's a jarring headline. Economic populism is a dead end for Democrats. That's the title on a recent op-ed piece written by a couple of longtime political flacks for Wall Street and published, naturally, in the Wall Street Journal. When the barons of big money start rolling out such scolding screeds, it's not because they really think populism is a loser, but because they're terrified by the fact that it has already gained mass appeal and is on the move all across grassroots America. Indeed, to put a thin veneer of legitimacy on this op-ed, they had to resort to the fiction that it is a political warning written to Democrats by Democrats, specifically by an inside-the-beltway outfit calling itself Third Way. But this group is to authentic Democratic Party principles what near beer is to stout, only not as close. Third Way is just the same old Wall Street way. While it wears a Democratic mask, it pushes for policies that are Wall Street wet dreams, including gutting and privatizing Social Security. Why would a group wanting you to believe that it has genuine Democratic genes be an advocate for further enriching Wall Street's Republican elite at the expense of America's middle class and the poor? To find out, just peek behind Third Way's organizational curtain. You'll see that its funders and governing board include no one from labor, senior citizens, consumers, environmentalists, small farmers, students, African Americans, Latinos, and other core Democratic constituencies. Instead, of its 29 board members, 20 are Wall Street bankers, hedge fund hucksters, or venture capital vultures. This is Jim Hightower saying, Third Way dead ends at Wall Street. So, fronting for the selfish interests of its backers, it doesn't want any party championing economic populism. But the people do, and that's who Democrats should heed.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Tomorrow, the president will set the bar a little higher, maybe look towards the future, say, you know what? We're going to talk big ideas. We're going to talk about, hey, opportunity for actual working people. And back to what I said right when he took office. My hope was is that he would be the guy who saved the reward of work. And it was that simple. It sounds simple, doesn't it? Fair day's work for a fair day's pay. Back to a opportunity to build on that middle class. That hasn't happened to this point. Because, understand, he took over the worst economy in, well, in my lifetime. And like I said, in probably most people's lifetime. And not just my words. I think just about every rational, sane economic organization said, you know, it was horrible. It was the worst since the Great Depression. But what you're seeing this pushback. And I think, as Brendan pointed out, Alec pushing back against it, the very wealthy pushing back against it. So I happened to see this fake news on Fox little clip that someone sent me.
Now, over the weekend, White House senior advisor Dan Pfeiffer evidently was on Fox News Sunday, where he said that, you know, what I said, Obama inherited this horrible situation. It was a big pile of steam and you know what. And Pfeiffer said, you know, Obama inherited the worst economic situation since the Great Depression, which is true. But this guy, Bill Hemmer, the host of America's Newsroom over at Fake News on Fox, stuttered through a talking point, because it had to be written for him. I don't think that he would have thought this on his own. Talking about this statement and talking about, well, you know, I heard that and I don't know if that's what they're saying to placate the left or whether it's something they truly believe. No, it's not something to placate the left. It's something that's fact. And I know on the far right, believe seems to be, you know, your belief seems to be what you need. I just don't believe it was as bad. No, the facts say it was. According to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the last 3 months of the Bush White House, the last 3 months of 2008, the economy contracted by almost 9%. They said it was the fastest rate of decline in 50 years. Since they began collecting this data. The Economic Policy Institute called it the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities said that the recession gave us unprecedented job losses. And if you go back and think about it, we were in free fall, losing hundreds of thousands of jobs per month. And as the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities points out, long-term unemployment rose to historic highs. They say that the largest share of the labor force unemployed for more than 26 weeks rose higher than at any point in the past six decades. So what's the answer? Well, the answer is doing what North Carolina and Florida and other places have done. If, you know, more than 26 weeks is what it is, we need to just be cutting people off at the knees at 12 or 14 or 18. You know, the thing is, I remember how bad it was. I remember turning on the news and going, oh my goodness, we're in free fall. But I also remember Ben Bernanke saying, we're going to do whatever it takes to bail out Wall Street. We haven't heard that about Main Street. We haven't heard that about working people. We basically said, you know what, screw them. Let's let them lose their homes. Yeah, screw them. Let them lose their jobs. They'll find another one if they're resilient enough. Instead of holding the people accountable, I still want people locked up, and lots of them. But maybe that's not going to happen, because maybe we have to pay too much homage to the chair. Maybe the 85 richest people in the world who control more wealth than half of the population of this globe. Maybe that's too important. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
A broad coalition, including labor, farm, internet, and environmental groups, are in the midst of a 10-days to stop fast-track movement against the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement. Hundreds of organizations are protesting the secret negotiations that will produce the TPP-NAFTA-style trade agreement. The Obama administration is pursuing fast-track authority to try and take the TPP straight from corporate-dominated secret creation sessions to a congressional vote.
with no chance to debate or amend the deal. Melinda St. Louis with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch says agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership are bad for workers, bad for the environment, and threaten the ability of the U.S. to enforce environmental regulations. And she says 20 years of data on NAFTA has convinced economists across the board that these deals are raw deals for all but the corporate elite.
The reality is that economists across all stripes, even those who have supported these types of trade agreements in the past, all admit this model of trade agreement is a major contributor to income inequality, to the increase in inequality among Americans.
St. Louis says support of the TPP puts Obama at odds with his stated goal of addressing income inequality.
Among the Obama's base, there is massive opposition. In his own party, this is not something that is popular at all, including in the leadership. And so if he does choose to, in the State of the Union address this coming Tuesday, if he chooses to push for fast track, he will be at odds with the vast majority of his party, and unfortunately will be undermining his stated legacy issue of trying to combat income inequality.
Public Citizen is urging people to call Congress opposing fast track authority for the TPP. Efforts to raise the minimum wage are underway in 30 U.S. states, from Alabama and Alaska to Florida, New Hampshire, Idaho, and many states in between. Democrats are pushing these efforts to raise state minimum wages. The highest minimum wage proposal is in Massachusetts, where the measure would raise it to $11 over 3 years. States can raise their minimum wages above the federal level of $7.25 an hour. Democrats support raising the wages. Republicans generally oppose it. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, unions added 162,000 new members in 2013. Private sector union ranks actually grew by 281,000 workers, but losses of 118,000 union workers from the public sector kept the net gain to 162,000. The overall percentage of American workers in unions held steady at 11.3%. The Department of Labor says union workers have higher median wages, $950 a week, compared to $750 for non-union workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Let's get started. You ready?
I'm ready.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. I'm sitting here with Ethan Rome, Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, HCAN, a group that did an amazing job during the run-up to passing this law, getting folks aware, active, engaged. Outstanding work. Ethan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at the group that you're the director of, did an amazing job during the push for this, and lots of boots on the ground, lots of engagement, good stuff.
That's been our job, and over the last 5 years, which has been the time period for our campaign, we've been lucky to be able to work with labor unions and community organizations, all of whom made up our coalition.
So now we're at the point where, you know, we've got this. It's about educating. It's about expanding. It's about people getting involved. But it's about moving forward as well. Because I see healthcare as that one thing. That without healthcare, there's no way in a cold day in Hades you're ever going to be anywhere near the middle class. Without that security, I don't know how you can survive in this country without that healthcare security.
Healthcare security is an important step right now in dealing with the income inequality that we're finally all talking about.
Yep.
And so we talk about the minimum wage. That's important. Raise it. Move towards a living wage. We talk about other kinds of issues that help people make ends meet. College, dealing with college loans, for example, student loans. Healthcare is a critical part of helping people move forward. And that's why it's been so important, and it is so important, to push back on these governors who are refusing to expand Medicaid, leaving dollars on the table and denying people health care who would otherwise get it. It's outrageous.
It is outrageous. You know, we've got a governor who says he's going to take it with all of these, with all this junk he's thrown in the middle of the road that I don't know that we ever get around. You know, this idea of job requirements and paying premiums and all of this stuff seems to me to be a guy who wants to say in election time, hey, I'm willing to take it, but in practice, there's no way in hell he wants this to be passed.
No, and I don't know what the guy's intentions are. I just know that when you say you want to expand Medicaid, and then you create so many hoops that the folks doing the Olympics in a few weeks couldn't do it, that just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And now let's talk about let's talk about what this links to, because y'all have had some voter suppression in this state.
But thank goodness our Supreme Court, our court, unconstitutional.
And thank goodness is right, because what we've got is a crew of governors all over the country who were bought into this Tea Party agenda, who were owned by folks like the billionaire Koch brothers. And they're not expanding Medicaid. They're also trying to make it harder for people to sign up in the marketplaces where you can get insurance
right.
under the new health care law. These are the same governors who are doing voter suppression, who are trying to make it harder for African Americans, Latinos, students, elderly folks, making it harder for them to vote. These are the same folks who are doing economic suppression, denying folks an increase in the minimum wage, pushing back on anything that would help folks with a living wage. These are the same people that are trying to deny people the right to collectively bargain. For example, fighting back on the issue where everybody who is in a collective bargaining agreement has to help fund the unions that provide that. And, you know, like, look at a Scott Walker in Wisconsin. Goes after the very right of workers in the public sector
right.
to bargain for better wages and benefits, but equally to bargain for improving their jobs so that they can improve the services for the people they represent.
Well, back in 2011, the program went to Wisconsin. We were literally sleeping on the marble floor there in the Wisconsin Capitol. And I remember broadcasting from there, you know, saying, hey, look, all of this stuff that we're seeing in Wisconsin, all of these attacks on public sector workers, all of these attacks on people with the Badger Care at the time, all of these attacks are coming to Pennsylvania. Understand, you need to be organizing today, because it's all part of the billionaire playbook. And we're seeing it right down the line, the attacks on health care, the attacks on workers' rights, the attacks on regulations, insane free trade policies, all of this stuff designed to destroy the American middle class and really put us into the two Americas even further than John Edwards had talked about. We have the class of the Kochs and those folks, and then the rest of us who are going to be scrambling for crumbs that maybe they leave behind.
And that's what's so important, because your point about this, and you mentioned trade. We've got this trade agreement that folks are talking about behind closed doors. None of us hear about it. None of us hear about it. It's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
I know my listeners hear about it all the time.
I know you talk about it. Most folks don't, and they don't talk about it because it's happening behind closed doors. It's not.
So, isn't that amazing, though? Because this was the president who said the most transparent administration in history, yet this 600 trade advisors, do you know any of the corporate lobbyists, otherwise known as trade advisors, who get to sit in these meetings? Because I don't know any.
No, I generally don't hang out with these multi-million-dollar pharmaceutical CEOs. Shockingly, they're not inviting me over to cocktail parties. I don't understand what's up with that. But it is true that we've got a trade agreement that's being negotiated behind closed doors. Nobody can participate except, as you say, the 600 trade representatives who are accountable fundamentally and work for the big pharmaceutical companies and then all the other kinds of interests. And as a result, what we have is an emerging policy that is just fundamentally crap for workers, for health care, for people who want net freedom. Right? It's an extraordinary thing. This right now, there's provisions in this trade agreement that would essentially make it impossible for the United States to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for better prices.
But I thought the Bush plan, prescription drug plan, already gave that away.
That's why it's so important. That's why it's so important, because a lot of us are fighting to eliminate that. A lot of us are fighting to eliminate the law that prohibits Medicare from negotiating for better prices. That's a critical thing. For those of us who care about the public option in the future within our health care system, which is very simple, it's just having within the Affordable Care Act the ability for people to choose a publicly sponsored health care plan instead of a private plan. And we all know what that is. It's called Medicare.
Let me stop you there, because that's something I don't think I've heard at all, that moving forward, and I've thought about it in other ways, where this trade agreement would preclude us from doing anything for the public good. You know, we couldn't have Buy American provisions or Buy Pennsylvania provisions in any laws. So what you're saying is maybe even into health care, that this trade agreement could affect how we deal with health care in this country?
Yes, and the particular example that I'm mentioning is it allows pharmaceutical companies to go after regulations and laws that essentially limit their ability to make profits the way they want to now. And so New Zealand, for example, has the strongest laws that allow them to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies. They get the best prices, we get the worst. And so pharmaceutical companies are going after those laws. But the idea is very simple. What they want to do is eliminate our ability altogether to negotiate better prices. And so what that means is when we talk about the public option in the future, the ability to have a publicly sponsored plan for all of us to buy into, again, essentially Medicare. Medicare is going to work better if it can negotiate better prices right. with pharmaceutical companies, because that's one of the things that will bring this down, bring prices down. And that's what's so important about this agreement. And as everybody knows, the more common examples are environmental regulations, food safety regulations, tobacco regulations, and then, of course, the rights of workers to have better jobs and jobs that actually pay well with good benefits so that we can have an American middle class.
There's been nothing in this agreement, and I've talked about it extensively. There's been nothing in this that I've seen that benefits me or any of the working people that I know. Why are we pursuing it? I mean, it makes no sense when the vast majority of the people in the country are going to be harmed by it. We learned that from NAFTA. We learned that from all these other neoliberal trade agreements that we've had rammed down our throats. At some point, when do we stand up and say, no?
We have to do that right now, because when you talk about neoliberal, we're talking about people I like and respect and that you like and respect on so many different issues. But somehow, when it comes to trade, we all agree trade's good, but these folks go off the reservation in a major, major way. And, you know, it's bad foreign policy and it's bad domestic policy.
Yep. It's just bad all the way around. Ethan Rome, I appreciate you taking time for us. It's always great talking to you, seeing you here at these events. But you got to come on the program other times than just here.
I'll be happy to do it.
Good deal.
Love to. Thanks
Ethan
so much.
Ethan Rome, thanks so much. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. They were giving me the finger. So you got somewhere to go. No, please come back.
I'll get to the CWA thing.
Good deal. You got my card and all that.
I do.
Beautiful.
Here's a jarring headline. Economic populism is a dead end for Democrats. That's the title on a recent op-ed piece written by a couple of longtime political flacks for Wall Street and published, naturally, in the Wall Street Journal. When the barons of big money start rolling out such scolding screeds, it's not because they really think populism is a loser, but because they're terrified by the fact that it has already gained mass appeal and is on the move all across grassroots America. Indeed, to put a thin veneer of legitimacy on this op-ed, they had to resort to the fiction that it is a political warning written to Democrats by Democrats. Specifically, by an inside-the-beltway outfit calling itself Third Way. But this group is to authentic Democratic Party principles what near beer is to stout, only not as close. Third Way is just the same old Wall Street way. While it wears a Democratic mask, it pushes for policies that are Wall Street wet dreams, including gutting and privatizing Social Security. Why would a group wanting you to believe that it has genuine Democratic genes be an advocate for further enriching Wall Street's Republican elite at the expense of America's middle class and the poor? To find out, just peek behind Third Way's organizational curtain. You'll see that its funders and governing board include no one from labor, senior citizens, consumers, environmentalists, small farmers, students, African Americans, Latinos, and other core Democratic constituencies. Instead, of its 29 board members, 20 are Wall Street bankers, hedge fund hucksters, or venture capital vultures. This is Jim Hightower saying, Third Way dead ends at Wall Street. So, fronting for the selfish interests of its backers, it doesn't want any party championing economic populism. But the people do, and that's who Democrats should heed.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the end of the world, I'm told, coming March 31st, as the Obamacare health plan goes into effect, the end of the enrollment period. And then I'm not sure why it was the 31st. I thought the 1st would have been the end of the world. But, you know, as with all of the end timers, they keep changing the date. When one passes, make up another one. Just a minor interpretation. I'm sitting here with Rhett Buttle. He is the Vice President of External Affairs at Small Business Majority. Rhett, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So business not going to collapse at the end of March. There'll still be maybe a job left, something?
Businesses are not gonna collapse. We've seen lots of changes in our country, and you know, I think one of the important things that I'm hoping we can discuss a little bit today is, you know, actually there's a lot of economic opportunity in the healthcare law or Obamacare for business owners.
You know, as a small business owner myself, you know, you look at this, healthcare is not something that I want to have to be saddled with. It's not something I know an awful lot about, nor should I. I don't understand why business doesn't want to get rid of this, what I think is a liability. I don't want to be between you and your health care or you and your family's health care. I want you to come do a job for me. And health care is something that shouldn't, I don't know, that should be the purview of the employer class.
Well, look, we have a long-standing tradition of employers offering health care in our country. And for some employers, it makes sense, and for some, it doesn't. It really just matters what sort of employer you are. You know, we see a lot of high-tech employers, right? Small business owners, you're trying to compete with Google or, you know, with other, you know, huge internet companies. You're probably an employer that wants to offer a competitive health care package to, you know, make sure that you're getting the employees that you need in order to grow your company. However, there's some employers who need access to great quality health care for great employees, but they're not in the business of healthcare. You're exactly right. They are, you know, they should be the best at whatever widget they make or whatever products they make, and healthcare should not be a consideration for them. And one of the things that this law does is it actually gives employers the opportunity to make that decision.
Yeah, because I've talked to a number of small business owners who have said, you know, I focus my attention on what I'm supposed to be doing and what I'm doing for my business, but the healthcare part of it is, you know, I'm dealing with this person who's now put me into these small pools and my rates keep fluctuating all over the map. It just seems to me to be logical that you give some small businesses the consistency, the certainty, and I know the Republicans talk an awful lot about certainty. To me, this seems to be one of those things that would give those employers some certainty.
I think that's right. Look, the law creates really two opportunities for business. One is that, you know, there's going to be a completely new marketplace being stood up, the small business health options marketplace, and that is a new marketplace where actually, versus the pools being so small, it's going to actually broaden that pool and give small employers the ability to do that. So for small employers who want to offer, they're able to do that. Now, there's also the option if you're a small employer and you have less than 50 employees, it is not your responsibility to offer coverage. And that's 96% of all small businesses in our country fall under that threshold of 50 employees. But the good news is your employees still have an opportunity to get a health care. So just because you're not offering it because you're under that 50 threshold, it doesn't mean that you can't be helpful to your employees in getting coverage through the new marketplace. And so there's a lot of flexibility for employers in this and a lot of opportunity for a lot more people to get covered.
Yeah, there's a frame, and one that I prescribe to, that this is going to open up opportunities for people like me who want to go out and start a small business. They're going to put their own shingle. Maybe they're going to leave the big company and try something. And it might actually spur some economic development, some entrepreneurial growth, if you will. It might actually get people trying new things.
Hey, look, one of the biggest barriers to starting a business, a small business, is health insurance. And, you know, you can trot out so many studies that'll tell you that. Everyone knows there are a lot of folks who work at, you know, very large corporations who have great ideas, and they want to go out and start a small business. They want to start the next Google. They want to become the next Steve Jobs. But they can't do that because they need access to health care. And this law changes that opportunity for them. Now folks have access as an individual to go and get health insurance on the new marketplace. And we really think that that's going to help entrepreneurs go out there, start new companies. They can get good access to health care and create jobs. And so the fact that these folks have the opportunity to do that is a step in the right direction towards creating more economic growth.
Now, you know, I look at this and, you know, I've so many of these right-wing attacks that I see. And, you know, the Republicans claim they're the party of small business. And, you know, I look at this as an opportunity for small business to grow and to compete a little bit better. Because as you said a moment ago, you know, you need to fight with the Googles. You need to fight with these huge corporations. I don't know that a small business can compete with health care or with benefits because the costs are so outrageous.
Yeah, well, I like to say small businesses aren't political. They're not Republicans and Democrats.
No, they're not.
Small businesses are about growing their businesses. They're about being part of their local communities. And so, you know, for them, this isn't a political issue. This is, you know, making sure that they can get health care. And for the small businesses who are lucky enough to employ people, their employees are like their family. They care about their employees. They want to get them the best coverage. And so providing these new opportunities is really a good thing for them. And, you know, the fact that some of them may now not have to think about health care, like we said, allowing them to focus on what they do best, whatever that product is, that is going to make them more competitive. That is going to allow them to be more competitive with corporations. You know, and we all want more competition in this country, and we all want to give small business owners a fair shot. I always like to say small business owners, they don't want a handout. They just want a fair shot at competing. This law makes steps to let small business owners.
I agree with you. The small business aren't on either side of the aisle. They're just on the treadmill trying to make it to the next day. I agree. But this issue has become politicized.
Yeah.
And this issue and small business has been used as the political football back and forth because we keep hearing this rhetoric time and time again that anything we do is going to kill small business.
Yeah, I think the unfortunate thing here is that, you know, it's created a lot of confusion for business owners. And, you know, folks look to particularly small businesses, their employer, as sources for information. And because small business has been used as a political weapon, it's created that confusion. And so, you know, that's part of the reason our organization, a lot of organizations, are really committed to getting out and just getting the facts out. You know, at this point, you know, the healthcare law is the law of the land, and, you know, most folks have accepted that, and the really important piece is to understand how it's going to affect you and affect your business, quite frankly.
So if I'm a small business owner, what does March 31st look like for me? Let's say I already offer my employees insurance. Let's say that, you know, it's hugely expensive, but I'm able to do that. What is the new year look? What does the year look like for me?
Well, small business owners actually, believe it or not, have more flexibility than even individuals in this law. So, you know, we have an open enrollment period. So the date you're referring to for individuals is March 31st. Small businesses can actually enroll in any time, and so they are not subject to an open enrollment period. So, you know, if small business owners want to get insurance now, they can. If they want to wait a few months and look at what their options are, that's totally fine as long as that's at the end of the month. The important thing to know here is you have more options. If you want to stay with your current plan, that's great. If you want to look at your new plans on the small business marketplace, that's a new opportunity for you too. And you also have the flexibility as a small employer. So the open enrollment period that we're hearing about right now, that's really important for individuals, really important if you're a self-employed individual. Those people are small businesses too. But if you're a small business owner with employees, you actually you don't have a timeline for when you need to enroll. And so, you know, I would say that the most important thing to do right now is to get educated, look at what your options are, take a peek on healthcare.gov. You know, we have these new marketplaces are available. We're hearing from lots of small business owners who not only get the healthcare tax credit that's in the law just for small businesses, but also that they're seeing more options are available to them on the marketplace.
So let me ask you this, though. You know, as a small business owner, I could probably get it for myself, but what about the employees? Can you go and shop for the plan that you may be getting from one of the Aetnas or one of the Cignas or one of those? Can you go to this site and compare for your employees?
So one of the really exciting things about this is, you know, one of the reasons small employers have been disadvantaged against large employers is that large employers can often offer their employees multiple healthcare plans. And in the past, small business owners, because as we talked about before, the pools have been so small,
right,
they haven't been able to do that. But now they are going to be able to. So the small employer actually picks a contribution if they decide that they want to offer coverage, and their employees then actually pick whether they want Kaiser or they want Aetna or what level of plan. And if they want to increase their contribution as an individual, they can do that for the first time, and they get to choose what their plan is. So we call it employee choice, and we think that's a really good thing because the employer is still committed to making the contribution, but the employee gets to choose what plan is best for them and their family.
And you might actually benefit from lower premiums by having a much larger.
Well, and it requires the insurance companies to, you know, really create products that are competitive, right? So, you know, before you could just lock in, you know, one employer and you would get all of that business, all the people who worked for them, right? But now you're not just competing for the employer's business, you're competing for all their employees' business. And the reason that's a good thing is because now insurance companies will really have to design plans that are really attractive to individuals because consumers are now making the choice about what's best for them and their family. You have more people entering the marketplace. And so we really think it brings transparency and accountability.
Well, that sounds like good stuff. I suggest people go to healthcare.gov and check it out. But So last thing, you know,
yeah.
No end of the world March 31st?
No end of the world March 31st, not for individuals or not for businesses. You know, I encourage folks to check out our website, smallbusinessmajority.org. We do free weekly webinars for business owners and learn about what your options are.
All right. Rhett Butel, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk. Thanks
Thank
a lot.
So much.
I appreciate it.
Yeah,
great
appreciate
talking
it.
Do you have a card by any chance?
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Last week, Fox host Mike Huckabee accused Democrats of telling women that, quote, they cannot control their libido or their reproductive system without the help of government. When Huckabee went on Megyn Kelly's show to defend his comments, Kelly clarified why people took issue with what he said.
You put it in terms of having to control, that the Democrats believe that women need the government in order to control their libidos. And that sounded to many like you were placing a judgment on it.
But when Huckabee went on Fox and Friends the next day, it was clear he still hadn't learned from his mistakes.
That Democrats are the ones who have denigrated women and demeaned them. That what they've got to have is a prescription for birth control and getting a free abortion. If they get that, well, you can calm the women down.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Hey, this is the Rick Smith Show.
So I got my email from GOP USA. Breaking news. Big headline. Breaking news. Hey, potheads, listen up. Marijuana makes you stupid, the GOP USA people said. Nobody wants to acknowledge the obvious fact, it says. But that's what the whole legalization debate is all about. Doctors warn that pot smoking impairs young people's thinking, which, of course, makes them, here it comes, much more likely to sign up for Obamacare. Well, you know, hey, whatever you can, right? Whatever you can to get it done. That's funny, actually. Anyway, here to talk about what's going on in Washington, D.C., around the world, we got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, what do you think? It makes you stupid, I guess, now, right?
I'm actually going to accuse you of making that up because I can't believe something like that would actually be sent out.
I will send you the email after we're done.
Oh, my God, please do. I mean, it all makes sense now. You know, legalize pot and, brainwash them into joining death panels.
There you go. Join up and just, you know, go along with the Tea Party.
Yeah. No, that is curious. Especially considering now that, you know, the whole pot legalization movement hasn't really been a progressive issue for a while. It's now more of the kind of libertarian domain.
Yeah, that's what blows my mind. I mean, you would think that the far right would be all in favor of it. But no, it's because, you know, a Democratic state like Colorado's done it, so it must be one of those hippie liberal things.
Oh, there we go.
So you going to the big Super Bowl this coming weekend?
No, I'm not going to the Super Bowl. I'm actually co-hosting a radio show in the lead-up to that for, something that's totally unrelated. But I am going to the State of the Union tomorrow night, which is, kind of the same thing with some people, but those people are kind of terrible, boring people.
Yeah, well, you know, you might actually be able to get a ticket to the Super Bowl, because evidently it's going to be the cheapest ticket in the Super Bowl since, I guess 2002.
Yeah, and I'm from San Francisco, so I was all with the Niners, and then we're suddenly heartbroken in one quick instant.
Yeah, well, we'll see how I feel on Sunday after if the Broncos lose. I'll be very unhappy. What genius thought of, let's have a Super Bowl in New York in January?
I mean, that's a good question. You know, even beyond this, kind of weird disparity that we've had with the polar vortex and stuff, New York has never really been a good place to be for, these kind of months. You know, it's just a step above Boston, I guess.
Yeah. So let's talk about the big State of the Union address tomorrow. What is the, what's going to be on the agenda?
The White House has been pretty coy so far over what we are exactly going to see. We do know, according to Carney, that there's going to be some discussion about jobs, improving the economic situation for the middle class, and also some talk on the environment. He today said that people were going to be excited by what the president had to say and that there were going to be some surprises. Whether or not that's going to really formulate or how that's going to look remains to be seen. But he also, refused to answer whether or not he was going to, address gun violence or gun control, which, of course, has been one of the, issues that comes into the spotlight time and time again with each new shooting. But what we do know is that the First Lady is going to be inviting Jason Collins, the first, openly homosexual professional athlete from the NBA. She's also going to be inviting two survivors from the Boston bombing, as well as the fire chief from Moore, Oklahoma, which, of course, suffered a massive tornado, as well as the D.C. Teacher of the Year. So, pretty interesting box set up for the First Lady.
Yeah, and I see that they're going to have some low-wage workers come in as well. A couple of fast food workers, I guess, have been invited as well.
The Democrats are certainly bringing in quite a few of the long-term unemployed in an effort to try to raise up the issue that unemployment insurance really to be continued. So that's their main focus. And so far we haven't really heard if there's going to be any crazy surprise guests beyond Sean Hannity, who was apparently invited. So far this year it doesn't look like Ted Nugent is going to be showing up, which is kind of a bummer.
And, the thing is, you had a really good interview with him last year, didn't you?
I did. I actually got up to tell Ted Nugent to his face that he was the second greatest the second best Detroit rock star after Iggy Pop, which felt pretty good, He didn't seem to appreciate it much. And actually, I thought about it after and realized, he's probably I'd have to count all the members of the MC5, and I'd have to count maybe the White Stripes and a whole bunch of other Detroit bands before even considering Ted Nugent. So there we go.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I go, I think the Bay City Rollers were from Detroit.
Okay, in that case, yeah, Saturday night, yeah, no, it's all good.
That would have been a real insult to him. Some bubblegum teeny bopper band from the mid '70s was better than he was.
I like the Bay City Rollers. Come on, see you next.
All right. Well, we all have our flaws, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So income inequality going to be front and foremost. We maybe talk about raising the minimum wage. What I'm wondering is, if we're going to talk about income inequality, are we going to be talking about people's right to join and form unions? And the big thing, in my view, that causes inequality and huge losses of jobs, these insane free trade agreements, like, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement?
That of course, probably isn't going to be, a major thing, considering how the administration has sort of handled that so far. A lot of progressives would love to see that being involved. But it doesn't look like that's going to be up there tonight. And in terms of income inequality, I don't think we're going to see anything, necessarily fire and brimstone from the president in that regard. But, since they have said that they're going to try to be, not necessarily divisive and whatnot. So, it's probably going to be sorely lacking of quite a few things that people would really like to hear right now.
Now, I'm of the mindset, though, at this point, that he's got to start thinking longer term. I don't think anything he comes out with is really going to get passed. So at some point, don't you start having to talk big ideas and call to people's greater sense and move the bar forward, maybe move the goalposts just a little bit, just a thought?
That's certainly true. Right now it looks like he is sort of a lame duck president. If he wants to, really kind of shake up the game now, it's going to be kind of hard for him to do, but this is a perfect time to capture the public's attention and maybe try to sway some support in his direction for any sort of lasting peace he would hope to achieve in his final few years.
I was never a big Ronald Reagan fan, but in looking back, I do think he had it in his mind at some point that it was about moving forward. It was about, after him, what kind of system will be set up? What direction is the country going? And I think, you go back, you talk about the grand collapse, you talk about what hasn't worked, and how we're getting just screwed in the worst way. But that's me. That's what I would be doing, which is why I'm not president.
No, that's very true. That's a good point. But, he's had quite some time now to really try to dwell on his legacy, to try to put something forward that would really last. He apparently is going to be talking about what he can do in his role as an executive. That's been a, reoccurring theme in recent months in the White House. So whether or not we're going to hear that he's actually going to use his position of power to achieve something like a, groundbreaking in the realm of the environment or whatnot, it's a little bit too soon to say. So But, you know, the White House did say surprises, so we'll see if there's anything that will, you know, last more than the, you know, one or two news cycles that the State of the Union usually gives us.
Yeah. So I understand that Angry Birds has given my all my information away. I download the app on my phone, the Angry Birds. I got a whole bunch of apps on my phone. I'm finding that this little gadget that I'm carrying around in my pocket is telling everybody a whole lot about me.
Yeah, no, exactly. This is something that came out today through a report from some files released by Edward Snowden. It looks like since 2007, the NSA as well as British intelligence have actually been tapping into Americans' apps and have been using them to try to contain sensitive information. And apparently this is just a pretty bizarre stuff. You know, they're not necessarily only getting your you know, location or gender or, you know, your Angry Bird score, I guess. But they can also try to, you know, track down whether a person is a swinger, according to the report, whether a person has certain sexual preferences, and just really kind of creepy information that you would not necessarily want the government to know about you.
So J. Edgar Hoover's risen from the dead, huh?
Yeah, you know, that's actually a very perfect analogy. You know, our own Victoria Jones from Talk Radio News actually asked Jay Carney in today's briefing about this, and his response was simply that the you know, NSA is not spying on average Americans, but nevertheless, the fact that they have this ability is something that should you know, certainly give Americans pause.
Yeah, you know, and all the other things. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that bothers me about, you know, about carrying this thing around, is they know where you've been, where you're going. I mean, the information that this thing kicks out, I don't think many people actually think about.
No, that's very true. You know, we live in a society right now where data is, you know, highly prized and also at the same time easily compromised. And, you know, you there's certainly a fine line between allowing it to be collected in the, you know, kind of private sector where the worst that they're going to do is try to make a buck off you and having it being collected through massive government surveillance, which is, you know, something that sends, you know, a much bigger chill.
And the thing that gets me is that let's say you decide you're going to run for president or run for anything. You know, I keep telling people, you know, they found Bill Clinton's emails. If they can find the emails from the president of the United States about Monica, they can find any. They can find yours.
No, that's certainly true. And, you know, all Americans probably have, you know, online lives that they don't necessarily want to be made public or necessarily want the government really snooping in on. And, you know, I think that's really what fuels a lot of this kind of fear over these programs.
And it's not just you either. I mean, from what I understand, your address book, your buddy lists, all that stuff, anything, any person you come in contact with, now you're associated with somebody else. Scary stuff.
No, certainly. Yeah, I know. It really is sort of a, you know, a creepy sign of the 21st century, you know, sort of the price, I guess, we pay for technology. But at the same time, it really just, you know, begs the question, when did this new technology really compromise our Fourth Amendment rights? And that's something that the NSA has not yet been able to answer.
Yeah, I go back and I, you know, it's been years since I've read 1984, but it's very eerie.
No, I mean, that's certainly true. We have, you know, we have a long history of being very wary of massive surveillance and, you know, the argument that, you know, nonstop security will keep us safe. And, you know, there's always a question that Americans like to ask, which is at what cost? And we're sort of finding it out slowly now.
So I see Representative Trey Rendell has resigned from Congress today. What's that all about?
Well, this is actually a pretty interesting about-face from Trey Rendell. He was previously the congressman who was arrested after purchasing cocaine in D.C.'s DuPont Circle. He was sort of an up-and-coming young Republican. You know, he ended up going to rehab saying that he was not a cokehead and that his main problem was actually alcohol dependency. He went for about a month and then came back and actually issued a very, you know, positive sounding op-ed in the local paper saying that he was going to continue to stay in Congress and was going to try to be the best leader that his district could, you know, imagine. And then just a few short weeks later, we now hear that he is actually going to be stepping down, which is, you know, opening the floodgates for a pretty competitive race in the district. There are already a few Republicans who are lining up for that, including some that have some major super PAC cash behind them. It is bringing about a, you know, close to what has been a pretty interesting chapter in you know, the final days of 2013.
So the question is did they force him out the door, or did he have some grand epiphany?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the party bigwigs, especially in Florida, were kind of anticipating for this. The person who is really aiming for a seat right now, who lost to him 3 years ago in a primary, his last name is Kriegel, I believe, has been raising money for a good chunk of time from some very wealthy donors. And I don't think, he would have done that just if there was only an off chance that he would step down. I think this is something that has been been in the works for quite some time.
Now we shall see. And I just sent you the email with the "Hey Potheads, listen up" story in it. You'll find it quite comical.
I can't wait.
There you go. Justin Duckham, always great talking with you, buddy.
Thank you, Rick.
Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A broad coalition, including labor, farm, internet, and environmental groups, are in the midst of a 10-days to stop fast-track movement against the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Hundreds of organizations are protesting the secret negotiations that will produce the TPP NAFTA-style trade agreement. The Obama administration is pursuing fast-track authority to try and take the TPP straight from corporate-dominated secret creation sessions to a congressional vote, with no chance to debate or amend the deal. Melinda St. Louis with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch says agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership are bad for workers, bad for the environment, and threaten the ability of the U.S. to enforce environmental regulations. And she says 20 years of data on NAFTA has convinced economists across the board that these deals are raw deals for all but the corporate elite.
The reality is that economists across all stripes, even those who have supported these types of trade agreements in the past, all admit this model of trade agreement is a major contributor to income inequality, to the increase in inequality among Americans.
St. Louis says support of the TPP puts Obama at odds with his stated goal of addressing income inequality.
Among the Obama's base, there is massive opposition. In his own party, this is not something that is popular at all, including in the leadership. And so if he does choose to, in the State of the Union address this coming Tuesday, if he chooses to push for fast track, he will be at odds with the vast majority of his party, and unfortunately will be undermining his stated legacy issue of trying to combat income inequality.
Public Citizen is urging people to call Congress opposing fast track authority for the TPP. Efforts to raise the minimum wage are underway in 30 U.S. states, from Alabama and Alaska to Florida, New Hampshire, Idaho, and many states in between. Democrats are pushing these efforts to raise state minimum wages. The highest minimum wage proposal is in Massachusetts, where the measure would raise it to $11 over 3 years. States can raise their minimum wages above the federal level of $7.25 an hour. Democrats support raising the wages. Republicans generally oppose it. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, unions added 162,000 new members in 2013. Private sector union ranks actually grew by 281,000 workers, but losses of 118,000 union workers from the public sector kept the net gain to 162,000. The overall percentage of American workers in unions held steady at 11.3%. The Department of Labor says union workers have higher median wages, $950 a week, compared to $750 for non-union workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Yeah, you're looking for experience. You're looking for someone with a proven track record. With the climate change about man-made global warming in this country. And everybody rushed to say, oh, we need to do something now about this huge problem. I didn't change. I stood tall and said,
this is the end.
This climate science and man-made global warming was not climate science, it was political science.
My only friend, the end of our
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So I look at Rick Santorum. Where is Tricky Ricky nowadays? I wonder what he'll be running for next. I miss him. You know, I was just talking to somebody over the weekend. And, you know, we were talking about Santorum. And it was one of those weird things. He goes, you know, I never quite understood, you know, why he was there. And I said, well, you know, because the fundamentalist wing of the Republican Party, you know, thinks he is somebody who's one of them. And he, because the person said, have you seen this photo? And he showed me a photo, I guess like on a Facebook page or something. It was really kind of very creepy. And he said it was very cultish. And oh, I remember who it was. We were talking about, when we went up to New Hampshire for the primary. And how they had, that's where the picture was taken. They did a round table with Tricky Ricky and he, you know, the wife was there and some of the entourage, and they said it was all like this really bizarre little cult thing going on. And I said, well, that's about it. The one very proud moment for the show, I gotta be honest, I was happy when it was set. The person who was doing the booking of the guests at the Radio Row that we were doing, the person running around saying, oh, hey, you're from Pennsylvania, go talk to that guy over there. Santorum's people said, under no circumstances will we talk to that man. And I got to be honest, the fact that he knew that just, you know, kind of made me happy. It made me smile. A little program like ours, getting into the head of someone like that, very, very interesting. Now, you know, I've had a history with Santorum. Back when I was doing weekends, I had worked, you know, to get Casey elected, and I had tried to do, you know, a whole bunch of other things. And Santorum's people actually, was almost I wouldn't even say it was a veiled threat. It was like an outward, you know, you've got to have him on, and we're going to push our way in. And I said, you know, look, you don't have to make threats. He wants to come and talk to me for an hour. I got no problem with that. I got no problem sitting down with him and railing on him. Question is, does he really want to come and sit and talk to me? And they said yes, and they scheduled the time. And 30 seconds before airtime, I mean, it was 30 seconds before we went on the air, I got a phone call. And I said, well, you know, thanks, but no. And it was another one of those moments where I had planned that he would do that. And predicted it was going to happen, and that's exactly what happened. But you know, I over the weekend, and that just popped into my head, that whole roundtable thing, and that picture just, you know, very cultish. And you know, I guess that's the segment. That's the segment of the population that's attracted to someone like Santorum, that mentality. Anyway, John sent me an email. This is a couple of days old, and it's one that I wanted to talk a little bit about. But you know, kind of in this whole paycheck deception thing. John writes, I am a recently retired AFSCME member who grew up in the 50s and 60s. My dad was a lifelong UAW member who, for the most part, raised three kids, vacationed for a couple of weeks every year, weekend fishing trips, etc., on one paycheck. And he capitalized all that. And he said, I can clearly see the demise of the union movement, NAFTA, GATT, etc. My dad back in the 70s tuned in the radio and said, listen to this guy. It was Lint Ball. Even he was briefly seduced by the slick, well-crafted arguments, as were so many lower to middle-class folks. He writes, today I read that the heir to the Amway fortune, who was successful pushing the right-to-work BS in Michigan, has vowed to use the same strategy in other blue states. He writes, to me, the plight of the workers is bad news. But was vastly underfinanced. We, the working class, need to do some good work. I look at this, and, you know, he's right. you know, it was very seductive. I mean, these are very well focused, tested arguments. Paycheck protection. Who could possibly be against someone's paycheck being protected? Who could I can't possibly be against that until you find out what it is. So you find out the poison that they're pushing. And there's nothing being protected. It's the same thing with right to work. Who could be against the right to work? Everyone should have the right to work, right? Absolutely. But you don't. You don't have any rights. Now, if there were a right to have work, I would be all in favor of it. And you go down the list of all of the, you know, the things that the poison that they push, who does it benefit? Who gets the money? Where does it go? How is the pie distributed? You know, this is the question we have going forward. And look, tomorrow the president's going to give his speech, and I hope income inequality is something discussed, but I hope there's something there that says, look, you know, it's the insane trade policies that he's pushing that have caused a huge bit of this. It's the attack on workers' rights and the ability to bargain that have done a big part of this. It's the destruction of the social safety net that has done a big part of it. And as we move forward, there's got to be some big thinkers out there who are going to look at our civilization, who are going to look at the planet and go, you know, it's not sustainable. We're heading for disaster. It doesn't take a genius to figure this out. We're heading for disaster. The jobs are leaving the country, and the ones that are coming back that we're paying hundreds of millions of dollars for are mechanized. So we're paying for our own demise. And it's, you know, it's, you can go down the list of all of the things that have really screwed work in this country. And now there's this view that's being pushed by our media, being pushed by the business community, that, well, you know, we could have a lot more jobs if we would just deregulate. And we could have a lot more jobs if we just did away with that pesky minimum wage. And we could have a lot more jobs if we just, you know, allowed for who knows what. Who knows what they're going to ask for next? How much? And the thing that gets me is it's never enough. I mean, you look at the, you know, we talked about this Oxfam report last week. That you got 85 people control the amount of wealth of $3.5 billion. Tell me that there's not something wrong with that. And you go, well, you know, at some point, don't we end up putting heads on sticks? I mean, really? I mean, when you look at a divide as big as it's getting, when is that tipping point? When is the tipping point when, you know, the people who are out there slugging it out, trying to make it to the next day, stop? Because, you know what? You can't do it anymore. I mean, you look at the numbers, you know, people are not happy. I saw, you know, statistics, I forget the one poll, like something like 65% of the country thinks we're going down the wrong path. Something like 67% of the country thinks that the income and the wealth of the country aren't distributed right. Not surprisingly, 54% of Republicans think that there's something amiss with how we divide the wealth of this country. And you look at how much wealth is there. And the way it's being distributed. And I go back to the Tea Party people who say, well, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. Yeah. I'm not shy about that. And I don't think any rational thinker would be shy about that. When you look at how much money is being concentrated, and understand, it's not just money, it's power. It's the ability to dictate direction of the nation. So when the Koch brothers had their big shindig this past weekend, where they had the who's who come in and say, "Oh, we're going to give out a whole bunch of money. This is the agenda." They weren't thinking about you or me. They weren't thinking about our kids. They were thinking about themselves and how they gain more power. That's it. It's that simple. It doesn't get any easier than that. And when you've got half the world's wealth owned by a handful of people, there's a problem. And the information we know, I mean, look, we know everything there is to know on this already. We know exactly what it is. Back in the mid-70s, we saw this push. Thanks to the Powell memo, thanks to the big corporations funding it. What we've seen is we've seen taxes falling precipitously, not just here in the U.S., but around the world. When you've got 29 of the richest 30 countries cutting their tax rates to accommodate the well-to-do and to create an even larger wealth class, you have got a problem. When you have got a tax code globally that allows for big corporations and the Mitt Romneys of the world to hide somewhere in the range of $21 trillion in these tax havens that we allow to be set up around the world, what do you think we're going to end up with? And you can just go down the list, and everything that has been tried to reel them in has always come with a loophole, has always come with something lobbied in at the last minute, always something very convenient. So that while we're looking over here and going, okay, well, we're taking care of this part of the wealth inequality problem. This part of it here we're working on. They create another one without really, and this is the thing that gets me. It's not that I don't think there aren't smart people who could figure this out. I think they're just smart people with a lot of money who figured it out the other way. And the politic of it is about, hey, well, it looks like we did something, right? While in essence, all we've done is a shell game. It's like three-card Monty. The queen is somewhere else. The queen has left the building, so to speak. But you look at this and you go, 85 people. You could bust the people around. And where did that wealth come from? Well, I think John's email pointed it out. His father was able to raise a family on one paycheck. He didn't have to take his kids to a stranger's house so that him and his wife could go to work. And I'm still fixated on that. I really am. It's one of those things that I feel very fortunate. And it goes back to the fact that I had a good paying union job. That we were able to survive and to get by, so we didn't have to take our kids somewhere. And I'm not saying anything bad about the people who are in the situation where they have to. I'm just saying it's unfortunate, because I know a lot of people would rather stay home if they could. But wages and all that have just stagnated to the point where, good luck. And there's no policy to help. That's the part that gets me. There's really nothing policy-wise, governmentally, that could help. Anyway, tomorrow at 10 a.m., I'm going to be at the Capitol in Harrisburg, the rotunda there, covering the big press conference. And I'm expecting, maybe several hundred to 1,000, maybe more people from across the state to come in and say, hey, this is ridiculous. Maybe you should do something that actually benefits we the people instead of things that punish us. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, Stitcher. See you back here tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming like the tide that flood beneath the lunar sky.